Welcome. The peace revolution now continues.
Breaker, breaker, 1-9. I'm in outer space with a microphone.
Calvin Coolidge once said, "Nothing in the world can take the place of persistence. Talent will not. Nothing is more common than unsuccessful men with talent. Genius will not. Unrewarded genius is almost a proverb. Education will not. The world is full of educated derelicts. Persistence and determination alone are omnipotent. The slogan, "Press on," has solved and always will solve the problems of the human race. Or as we like to say, just keep moving forward.
There is a peaceful solution called the Peace Revolution. Now let's take back America. There's a war and we're in. I know we can win it, so let's take back America. There was a dream, so believe it, and get ready to receive it. Now let's take back America.
Welcome to the Peace Revolution Podcast. I'm your host and navigator, Richard Grove, and this is where we step out of the confusion, fear, and anxiety of everyday life to relax into some knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. You're listening to Podomatic's number one rated podcast in higher education. Thank you for making time in your busy schedule to tune in and grow in the light direction. If you're a new listener, this podcast acts as a virtual classroom for adults designed to point out and provide useful perspectives, resources, and information. Each episode of this podcast contains a subject of study essential to building out your own comprehensive understanding of reality, all of which is focused on providing you with the history, context, references, and the various methods and tools so that you can learn for yourself that which public schools cannot afford to provide. Peace Revolution and all the educational media we create here at TragedyandHope.com is presented as a public service without corporate sponsorship and is published commercial free and presented free to the public thanks to the generosity of the subscribers to the Tragedy and Hope online community and the hard work of the media hosts featured at TragedyandHope.com. I encourage you to check the episode notes, references, and links for this and all episodes we publish at peacerevolution.org. I also invite you to click on the invitation link in the episode notes and participate in the Tragedy and Hope online community and learn how to apply this journey of discovery to your everyday life. And if after studying the episode notes you're looking to learn more, Peace Revolution has several partner podcasts, all of which likewise feature commercial-free educational episodes also presented free to the public, including CorbettReport.com, GnosticMedia.com, MediaMonarchy.com, RemedyRadio.com, and many others, each of which uniquely fills the void left by public schooling and mainstream media. Welcome to this second installment of a very special interview episode series of Peace Revolution, featuring the gentle tone, scholarly insights, and wealth of wisdom that combines in the form of John Taylor Gatto, the legendary educator, author, and icon of liberty who offers a lifetime of perspectives on the origins, intentions, and destiny of the compulsory public school system. The audio for this episode is taken from the second hour of the Ultimate History Lesson, A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto, which was filmed on July 4th weekend, 2011 in the Constitution State of Connecticut. This is the second hour of a comprehensive interview session which memorializes John's life's work and embodies our birthright as human beings. Truly an event which is relevant and relative to each and every one of us. You could even say that the ultimate history lesson is a template for you to create your own self-evolving map of life. So before we begin this week's episode, let me build out the ideas behind some of the problems, root causes, and potential solutions which will help to empower you through the process of self-discovering this world full of wonders for yourself. To begin, Knowledge is a map of that which exists. Now the question is that a metaphor or is that a lie? Think about it. What makes it interesting is that most of us aren't instructed in the art of how to discern one from the other, a metaphor from a lie, leaving most of us thinking of figurative metaphors as literal lies. But here's the difference. Metaphors and education are abstractions of what exists, which expand your options and your opportunities and open your mind. This is the essence of teaching. Propaganda and lies are abstractions beyond what exists. These abstractions limit your options and your opportunities and cloud your mind. It is the essence of predation. Metaphors which educate or are meant to teach through abstraction strengthen your volition and liberate your free will to choose. Metaphors which lie or are meant to deceive you through abstraction weaken your volition and negate your free will to choose. So let's call on a historical example of free will. In ancient Greece, the oracle at Delphi had the words temet noske carved into the gateway to the temple, instructing the kings and noblemen before entering to know thyself. Now, if you've never shared the irony, the oracle at Delphi was the Ponzi scheme of its day, which depended on those who did not know themselves to fill its coffers and enrich and empower the priests of Apollo. Indeed, to fall victim to con men and thieves is at its root cause, triggered by an individual's lack of ability to defend his mind from fraud. When it happens to an entire nation or even an entire planet, it is the lack of intellectual self-defense among the population, triggered by incoherence, indecision, and deficiency in identifying that which exists. A loss of knowledge of self among such large populations as we have today is not natural, as it is in direct conflict with the human species' instinct for survival. Realizing that knowing thyself is a sign of a mature human being comes at the cost of likewise realizing that until you start thinking for yourself, you are a bio-machine being programmed by the words, actions, and influences of others. To outgrow this reactive nature, to become responsible for your own body and mind, and to invoke contemplative thought, nature has empowered our minds with the abilities which allow us to ask questions between the stimuli we receive and the actions we take. Just as the key to maintaining our physical health is through learning how to meet and surmount physical obstacles, likewise the key to maintaining our mental health is to learn how to meet and surmount mental obstacles. Methods are the formulas that we use to meet and surmount obstacles, and methods act as tools, which are the keys to human survival. Since it is important to know thyself, and all too often this is not taught anywhere, it would make for the best opportunity for you and I to reach an understanding through the process of this preface to the second episode of The Ultimate History Lesson. I'm not asking you to agree with me or believe what I'm saying. I'm simply trying to provoke you into looking into these matters for yourself. And I'm not here to tell you what I think or to tell you how to think, but simply to describe the methodology by which I have learned how to think for myself. I'm simply going to take what we all naturally and implicitly know and state it in such a way that it becomes uniformly explicit, so as to make some useful tools which you can use to analyze this interview with John and which you can reuse in your life every day. So to get on the same page, here's a quick review of what it means to be a human being on this planet. This is our common ground. First, we have existence. We all share this planet. Second, we have the gift of perception. We are all perceiving what exists via our five senses: sight, smell, hearing, touch, and taste. Thirdly, we all have the power of mental conception. We are all actively forming word concepts in our minds of that which we perceive via our five senses. The language we use is simply a series of labels denoting every substance, action, attribute, and relationship which exists. And this is used as a tool to organize our thoughts as well as to meet our needs by communicating with others. These three layers, existence, perception, and conception, form the core of human consciousness, which provides the mental faculties of thinking about and reacting to that which exists. Conscious beings can also be conditioned to respond to stimuli, just as is done with animals. This happens when thinking is removed from the space between stimulus and response, and as a consequence, volition or free will to choose is lost. We as human beings are somewhat unique in our self-awareness of what exists, represented within the name of our own species, Homo sapiens sapiens, from the Latin words meaning wise man or knowing man. We are the only living species in the Homo genus and the most advanced of any hominid species. Humans have a highly developed brain capable of abstract reasoning, language, introspection, planning, emotional control, and problem solving. This mental capability combined with an erect body carriage that frees the hands from manipulating objects has allowed humans to make far greater use of tools than any other living species on Earth. Other higher level thought processes of humans, such as self-awareness, rationality, and sapience, are considered to be defining features of what constitutes a human being. Sapience is often defined as wisdom or the ability of an organism to act with appropriate judgment. The use of reason specifically is in the name of our species, Homo sapiens sapiens, reflecting our own recognition of our conscious abilities. Humans are uniquely adept at utilizing systems of communication for self-expression, the exchange of ideas, and organization of information. Humans create complex social structures composed of many cooperating and competing groups, from families all the way up through nations. Humans are noted for their desire to understand and influence their environment, seeking to explain and manipulate phenomena through science, philosophy, mythology, and religion. This natural curiosity has led to the development of advanced tools and skills which are passed down culturally. Humans are the only species known to build fires, cook their food, clothe themselves, create art, and use numerous other technologies. The study of humans is the scientific discipline of anthropology. Human growth consists of evolution, or the spiraling outward of our physical development through actions of the body. And human growth also consists of involution, or the inward spiraling of our mental development through the actions of the mind, called learning. One difference between human beings and animals or machines is the power of the internal conversation and self-inquiry. The attaching of words or concepts to what we sense through the five senses, which stimulates our thinking and planning, is unique, and when these abilities are left unused, we seem to lose our humanness, and the actions which define the line between man and animal becomes blurred. The process of integrating our perceptions via the five senses and forming mental conceptions is the activity known as reasoning. In the struggle for survival on this planet, each species has and uses the tools which nature has provided. Birds use their wings to fly, fish use their fins to swim, and human beings use their minds to apply reason to their perceptions. This is how civilization has given itself the capacity to mentally evolve over time. human beings uniquely can also discern, identify, use, and communicate ratios, which are the proportions derived from observing similarities and differences. The word ratio is the base for rational, which is the process of thinking which uses reason to discern and identify that which exists. Without ratios or reason, there could be no language, for words are used to divide reality into useful pieces through contrast and comparison. Reason, as described in conscious beings, is the origin of an awareness of cause and effect. This is contained in something called the prime ratio, 1:1, which is derived from the fact that for every cause, there is exactly one effect, and for every effect, there is exactly one cause. Thinking consists of asking questions and finding valid answers to identify that which exists, and reason is the process of thinking which delivers logical proof. This would not be possible if it were not for the prime ratio, cause and effect. Irrational thinking is a process whereby a non-logical method of decision-making is used, one which is in denial of cause and effect, and thereby the actions reflected by irrational thinking make no sense. This is where humanity puts itself in danger, taking action without reason. As human beings, we use philosophy as a tool to make decisions, to plan for the future, to resolve problems, to manage risk, and to support crisis management in our everyday lives. And ironically enough, the public school system doesn't deem it necessary to make such ideas as resolving our own problems and managing risk compulsory within its curriculum. Given that fact, it would now make sense to learn a bit about how we as human beings define knowledge. We do this by using our perceptions through the five senses to identify what exists. In philosophy, this step is called metaphysics. We then use a method to identify words to describe the concepts of that which exists as tools for communication and thinking. In philosophy, this step is called epistemology. We then ask the question and conclude in the form of a decision based on metaphysics and epistemology, what exists and how we describe it, what do we do now? In philosophy, this is the use of logic to remove contradictions and fallacious thinking in order to form our ethics and morals, which act as the basis of our actions. We then ask, how do we communicate the knowledge extracted from steps 1-3 and communicate it to others without ambiguity? This is the use of aesthetics and the active literacies, also known as rhetoric. The point being that the four layers of philosophy, metaphysics, epistemology, ethics, and aesthetics, contain the formulae leading to how truth is found, understood, and communicated as well as protected through the course of human history. This process of defining knowledge to increase certainty and facilitate communication allows us to effectively plan for the future. This is a skill essential and necessary to human survival. Using knowledge as our base, we as human beings then apply methods of decision making, and this forms the foundation of informed choice, free will, and liberty. It's also known as a science of volition. Without a method or science of volition to maintain your free will at all times, you are left to the chaos which erupts when we react to the world without thinking. This is the use of our natural reflexes against our own interests. This is the triggering of animalistic fight or flight reflexes, with the caveat of being manipulated by our reflexes if we do not force ourselves to think between the input of stimulus and the outcome of response. The manipulation of our stimulus and response reflexes, without conscious processes of thinking in between, leads to our being enslaved by the thoughts, words, actions of others, while simultaneously we succumb to loving our servitude as our own self-indenturement goes unrecognized. Without observation and active thought, we cannot attain understanding and freedom. So what can be done? Well, let's start with the obvious and build out into the ambiguous areas of problems so that we can all understand the solutions as they become known to us. We all share common needs: healthy food, fresh air, clean water, accurate knowledge to effectively plan for the future, and ownership over our own work, and thus this is our ability to be self-reliant. Without understanding our common needs, we cannot understand our common institutions, which are functions of civilization. The need for security, liberty, self-responsibility, civic responsibility, etc. Without these, we are not free individuals, as we cannot take effective action to support our own survival. A lack of understanding this chain of cause and effect yields a population which is dependent on authorities for its survival. Understanding is the process through which individuals become and remain free, and there is a step-by-step method which transforms fear and confusion into knowledge and understanding. The question is, what is the practicality of having a methodology of reasoning to dispel confusion and fear? A method of dispelling confusion allows one to learn anything efficiently, effectively, and with ease of mind. It allows one to discern fact from fiction, to ensure consistently clear thinking, and identify when we're being lied to, not to mention the improvement which is consequent to making informed decisions. This method also serves in a survival sense, as it is our method to protect ourselves from predators. What I'm talking about is literally the immune system of the mind, naturally created to protect our bodies. Without it, you literally have dis-ease. And if you aren't intellectually able to defend your mind, your body doesn't stand a chance. When individuals en masse are forced into a public schooling system which disrupts and disconnects our natural mental immune system, our intellectual self-defense, the nation then becomes incoherent, as it is composed of individuals. Volition, our decision-making process, our choice, our free will, is dependent on our mental immune system. To remove our choices, to force stimulus-response reactions, is to remove our freedom. And we as a people have an immunodeficiency, the cause of which, as you'll soon hear, is the primary function of the public school system. And as I mentioned earlier, metaphors and education strengthen your ability and unlimit your options. Propaganda and lies weaken your abilities and limit your options. This all leads to your ability to be self-reliant and have genuine self-esteem. The pragmatist William James described self-esteem as the ratio of your success divided by your expectations. But that's only possible if you have a comprehensive understanding of yourself and your environment, as this is the basis of both setting accurate expectations and realizing consistent success, the sum of which would then be your self-esteem. In order to survive, we must make ourselves into a fountain of utility and indispensable in our own survival. In doing this for ourselves, we can then become entrepreneurs or start our own businesses, or we can do this for someone else and be an employee participating in someone else's business. But regardless of which path, this is the formula for our own survival in this environment. We're all equipped with a brain, which is, to our perception, the most complex organism in existence. Our needs are met by our methods of learning, our use of tools, and our active communication. Public speaking, writing books, making films, even podcasting, these are forms of active literacies which enable one person to talk to many people at once. And due to the great potential held within the active literacy skill set, only the aristocratic managerial class was permitted through most of history, to learn and practice these arts of aesthetically communicating in such a powerful way. Our brain also allows us to do many things. Not unique among the human brain is its ability to plan for the future. And though ants, squirrels, wolves, and many other species of animals store food for lean times, people have to do much more than store food, and thus we need many tools to survive. We use tools to take effective action. We use calendars to plant crops. We use clocks to divide the day into useful parts. We use compasses to find our way from one place to another. These are the facts of life. Comparing today to America's agrarian beginnings, one might note that in the 18th century, America faced no widespread environmental catastrophe, and yet today we face many. The question is, what specifically in relation to this cause and effect has changed in the past 200 years? Well, today, the widespread tool of decision-making revolves around money, and in the 18th century, it revolved around the logic of survival. We need a healthy environment to survive, and we need a healthy mind in order to survive in our environment. This is the base of logic as a tool which predicates human survival. So what would happen if our ability to effectively plan for the future were undermined? You would have what we have here today, a failure to educate. Why are so many decisions based on money and not logic? It's due to the fact that the general public no longer has the intellectual fortitude to face the uncertainty and wring from it the drops of knowledge which lead to understanding. In fact, after 200 years of folly in America, it's time to recognize that we as human beings have natural predators whose purpose it is to control, harness, and drain each of us of our energy and figurative life's blood. They use words as weapons, force, fraud, and coercion as their tactics. They are organized, and we are not, which is largely a consequence of our going through the public schooling system. So the question is, why don't our public schools teach us this basic fact of human history, that we as human beings have natural predators? As the evidence illustrates, it is because the public school system was designed in its form and function by the predators of humanity. Why would a small group of people seek to deny the rest of us accurate knowledge of our history here as humanity? Denial of that which exists does not serve any of our best interests, and therefore it's irrational. As we come to verify this through our own journey of self-discovery, we can either face up to this fact and discuss conventional and unconventional countermeasures through learning, or we can remain with our heads in the sand, subservient to the fear and ignorance which would then continue to prevail. Fear is a disruption in the clarity of our mind, the clouding which occurs between our perception of what is via the five senses, and the formation of our concepts within our mind. Fear indicates that learning has yet to take place, that our concepts have yet to evolve and come into equilibrium with our perceptions. But once a method of learning is concluded, fear and confusion will be transformed into knowledge and understanding. What was once a survival reflex, fight or flight, is now being used to control us. For when the method of dispelling confusion is held secret from the public is propelled into uncertainty, fear, confusion, frustration, anger, and aggression on a daily basis. This makes the behavior of the herd highly predictable. It makes the job of the managerial class very easy. The real predators of humanity need your attention. They need your fear. They need you to panic and to react without thinking. But you don't have to give it to them. Our predators also have fears of their own, one of which being that they don't know how to control and manage individuals without the use of fear. Outgrow fearful thinking and learn to see beyond the fear, and you have literally outgrown the ability for others to control you with it. On June 5th, 1788, Patrick Henry laid out this following quote, addressing the delegates of the Virginia Ratifying Convention. Quote, "Sir, it is the fortune of a free people not to be intimidated by imaginary dangers. Fear is the passion of slaves." End quote. If we have lots of problems and we lack solutions, then learning has yet to take place. If problems are solved by invention and the form and function of public schooling breaks the inventive lever of curiosity, then is it any surprise that we, here in the early 21st century, after 100+ years of Prussian schooling in America, have grown incoherent and are now surrounded by seemingly insurmountable obstacles, pushing us toward extinction of our own population? Can we effectively resolve problems without first understanding the root cause and the consequences of our own history? I'm talking about history as it was, not how we'd like to remember it or how it was told to us, but history as it actually pertains to cause and effect reality. Because without this, we are prevented from knowing ourselves. And that is the key to controlling the human species. The occulting of useful information, better known as secrecy, prevents us from knowing ourselves through learning from our own history. Literacy has long been a foundational layer to be controlled by others. And without the active literacies being learned and practiced by all of us, we are forever to be the class which is managed, and by definition, not responsible enough to manage our own lives. The system uses literacy as a form of slavery, and it remains that way until a methodology of critical thinking is exercised actively and consistently by the reader. The system cannot effectively manage illiterate people, as they cannot be manipulated in widespread manner by the written word, and therefore, in order to preserve and proliferate itself, the managerial class has created compulsory public schooling. As a species, we face problems in all areas of common need. Our air is being poisoned, our water is polluted, our food is genetically modified, our bodies riddled with corporate chemicals, and our so-called leaders are being eaten alive by their own greed. The status quo is attacking the very nature of life on this planet, and in its course of consequence, taking away the fundamental rights to produce and consume our own food, to raise our own children, to preserve our own communities, and has dissolved the integrity of the fabric which makes up our own civilization. Indeed, this is irrational, but it doesn't have to stay this way. What's necessary is that each and every one of us begins a process of learning, asking questions, discovering answers, and communicating solutions. Reading books stimulates our internal conversation, and this is why the Latin word for book is also the same Latin word which means freedom, and that is what personal liberty is all about. If public schooling is dumbing us down, which then artificially extends our childhood by retarding our internal dialogue, clouding our curiosity, and irradiating our imaginations, then it is no wonder that it produces incoherence through denial of experience. It also breaks the trust barrier between parents and children. In examining public schooling, we find that the teaching of methods of success are absent from the curriculum. And the question is, why? Since America is provably growing more incoherent by the day, the question should be, are our public schools broken, or do they function perfectly for those who created them? As you'll soon learn in detail, the form and function of public schooling serves the corporations and the elite families who created them, and does not serve the needs of the students who go through the schools. That's their plan for you, but you don't have to continue to act it out. You can learn to do anything, and thereby plan your way out of this. And this is the next step which enables you to continue doing that. This is episode 42, The Ultimate History Lesson, A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto, Hour 2, plus commentary. Thank you for your support, and thank you for tuning in and not dropping out.
Major minds with a lot of influence who...
Can I have you hold that spot?
Oh, sure.
All right, roll cameras. See, this is what happens when you got real talent. It just goes.
Four cameras rolling? Red dots, everybody? Cool.
Floor is yours.
So we have this ominous continuity among major minds with a lot of influence, including transatlantic influence on the States. We have, prior to the break, Fichte in Prussia, Spinoza in Holland, and Calvin really beginning in Geneva and spreading all over where his theology spread. But the father of this, at least in the form of written documentation that's easily available, has to be Plato, the Greek aristocrat who speaks through the mouth of Socrates and writes two influential utopias, one well-known, The Republic, and one not so well known, The Laws, which is the product of his mature reflection on what needs to be done. And all four of these men, and we could, if we had time, do 40, but these four major names spanning European history agree that the ordinary population is A, very dangerous to the social order if it learns how to think and if its imagination remains intact. And furthermore, we have this corollary that there is no way to improve this. And what I've left out is the killer app that occurs in the middle to the end of the 19th century from one of the wealthiest families on planet Earth, the family of Charles Darwin, and their former Anglican minister-trained son, Charles, who in his second major publication, The Descent of Man, says that the evolutionarily retarded are fatally dangerous to the physical integrity of the human race, the advance of civilization, because of the few evolutionarily advanced, like the Scandinavian blondes and the English blondes, crossbreed, God forbid, with the Irish or the Spanish, evolution will march backwards into the swirling mists of the dawnless past, and nothing can change that. Maybe a few million years might change it. Certainly nothing that current generations can do. Darwin, of course, is in every school, including every elementary school in the United States, probably the world, and no one bothers to mention that he doesn't say the human race is evolving. There's a few, a fraction are evolving. Now put yourself, if you're watching this, in the position of a responsible person who learns that. As someone who's made worldly success, has a little bit of time on their hands and resources, and now you know that if these ordinary people walking around in the American democracy, if they happen to crossbreed with your daughter, evolution is going to march backwards. You now have a justification beginning in 1871, second to none. You can argue with Calvin. You can argue with Spinoza. You can argue with Plato. You can argue with Fichte. This is science and mathematics. And furthermore, an unknown connection that has for some reason escaped the attention of the Darwinians. Darwin's earlier cousin, Thomas Malthus, has said there is no way mathematically to feed the poor, because if you feed them, they'll reproduce more successfully, and then there'll be twice as many, then four times as many. That population expands geometrically, but food only arithmetically. So we, and of course in Darwin's diaries, he said that his pursuit of the secrets of biology are stimulated by the work of his cousin Malthus. Now we have, after Darwin's two blockbusters, the second of which...
I'm going to raise my hand from now on.
Yeah.
What's the full name of Darwin's Origin of Species?
The Progress of the Favored Races. And he does not use the term race the way we do. He recognized about 57 separate races, of which the Irish are on the very bottom. Thank goodness he said that, because a respectable percentage of every audience I speak to, that you'd otherwise be reluctant to say these things, so it's derived from, anybody here derived from a partial Irish background. You know, he said the Irish are hopeless. There is no hope for the Irish. Of course, what's left out of simply relating what Darwin said is his training as an Anglican minister. And if you happen to pick up the Anglican Book of Common Prayer, hundreds and hundreds of years preceding Darwin, you find that God's will is to divide all the living creatures and plants into an infinite number of layers, and to attempt to leave the layer you're placed in is the worst sacrilege at all. So that Darwin's theory, fully explicated, is the Anglican homily of obedience. Homily of obedience says exactly what Darwin says hundreds of years ago. Don't try to get out of your biological category because it's hopeless. And prior to that, don't try to get out of your spiritual category because it's hopeless. There's a great similarity between the two ideas. Now, if you set out to find evidence that this is so, it's much easier than simply setting out to look at the, you know, the abundance of natural forms. So the real actor in the piece, Darwin's a shy man, fantastically wealthy. That's been left out of all the, fantastically wealthy. The high-tech upper class purchase of the day was Wedgwood pottery, and that's the source of the Darwin family wealth. So Darwin's first cousin is a man I was taught in high school back in the early 1950s, is estimated to be the most intelligent single human being ever lived. I was told that over and over. His name, Francis Galton, a world famous explorer, mathematician, inventing little statistical formulae to discriminate shades of quality that the schools are infested with. And he has Mr. Galton, a worldwide following of Galton clubs, including in the United States. He makes several pilgrimages to the U.S. to spread the insight that a menace to the human race exists in 95% of the population, and there has to be a way to put them, render them harmless. School, recommended by Fichte, Spinoza, Calvin, and Plato, that's the way to do it. And we'll defend this with precise mathematical science. We will keep to ourselves the biological reason. Meanwhile, we've got to find a way for the biologically advanced to breed with one another. If you will trace the founding years of the elite private boarding schools in the United States, with the exception of no more than six, you will discover that all of them, male and female, emerge in the 30, including the women's colleges, the Seven Sisters, in the 30 years after the descent of man, which will be in every respectable library in the United States, and of course, overseas too. I urge you, especially if you're Irish, to pick it up and read it. You will not be disappointed to find yourself at the bottom of all the races on earth. Just as the English without Darwin would have agreed. You know. Well, anyway, so this package of high-level evidences, contentions, is capstone with scientific mathematical evidence and the proselytizing of Francis Galton, vigorous, rigorous. Out of that comes, in the period right after the American First World War, a phenomenon in country fairs all over America called the Better Families Competitions. You set up the criteria for ranking, and you know, you present your daughters like prize heifers to be rated by the judges. So we have a series of these reinforcements of Darwinian theory, which is really a reinforcement of Anglican theology or Calvinist theology or Platonic philosophy or Fichtean philosophy, or if you want to go liberal, Spinozan philosophy, until finally we get to this cap. So now the cap is off the tunnel to hell, because not only are people justified in setting up a form of schooling that's anti-educational, but they're doing either nature's work or the Lord's work. You decide. You want to go Calvin, you're doing the Lord's work. You want to go nature, you go
Spinoza.
Yeah. Yeah. So all of this wonderfully rich fabric of foundation is right on the surface. Someone has to point your attention to it. Please, no one watching say, oh, this fellow Gatto has spun off, you know, this phenomenal, interesting, but wacky theory. I didn't spin off anything. I took the dots and I connected them. And I said, they're identical from 300 BC until post Darwin Galton comes a German, a Prussian psychophysicist named Wilhelm Wundt, who is the premier behavioral psychologist on earth. And now let me spring a bombshell on all of you. The only place in the world for a long, long time, you could get a PhD degree, was either Prussia, University of Berlin, Leipzig, these little nests of Germanic countries. So from all over the world came the sons of the most powerful families, beginning in 1814 or 16 in the United States, when the guy who later became the governor of Massachusetts went over to get his PhD degree. By the 1870s, 1880s, it was a flood from Japan, from Russia, from everywhere. And now they return to their home countries, not because they have a PhD degree or they made presidents of universities, heads of government bureaus, because their families have clout. And now that's become the ticket to intellectual management.
Welcome back to the Peace Revolution. This is episode 42, the second hour of the Ultimate History Lesson, A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto. We've just listened to the first 15 minutes in which John drops a lot of information. There's just so much to go through in 15 minutes that I'm really glad that we're able to sit down at a virtual roundtable discussion and kind of flesh this out, because I know for the first four or five times that I watched the footage when I was first editing it together, I noticed I kept learning things that I'd missed completely because he drops so many facts so regularly. Let's go to Jan Irvin in California. What did you think about that first 15 minutes of hour two, Jan?
Well, I took a number of notes down, Rich, and the first thing that I thought we should bring attention to is this idea of Plato's utopia and this concept that's been pushed down for centuries, for over two millennia, at least since Plato's Republic and Laws. And it continues in the present with Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, with the Zeitgeist movement, with all of these ideas, especially in the New Age movement right now, floating around out there about, you know, bringing down the Fed, and we'll have this one world utopia with no borders and no government. And, well, excuse me, but isn't that the New World Order, having no borders and a world government and a one world money system and this type of thing?
Well, we know, and the New World Order does order out of chaos, and what it sounds like you're describing is chaos, because to take away government without first having autonomy yourself, to have critical thinking and judgment making,
it plays right into the hands of someone else who's there to control you, just like when the Egyptian military stepped in when they took down the Egyptian president. And so it's the same thing. Another thing that I wanted to mention is, you know, Gatto talking about the population and these elites claiming that if they increased food, the population would go up. I find this contradictory to facts, because in reality, it seems that the more, the better fed that people are, the more leisure time they have, the better educated they become, and the fewer children, therefore, they have. And people who are having many children that are surviving don't tend to have 10 or 20 children to replace the ones that are dying. And so I find that contradictory to the evidence out there that in each culture where the food and the education go up, population seems to go down. And something crossed my mind when he was talking about Darwin and, you know, just the Christian fish, and Darwin is being used to justify genocide all over the planet, not just against the Irish, but against the native. I just interviewed Kevin Annette for this week's show about the Canadian genocide, and these same types of ideas are still today being used against native
indigenous populations. Right,
and it doesn't stop there. I mean, these people think that they are genetically superior to the rest of us because they know the laws of grammar, logic, and rhetoric, and they are therefore sophisticated, the sophists, and so therefore they think that they're genetically superior and can decide who should live and who should die. Meanwhile, there, who knows how many future geniuses and whatnot they're killing off in the gene pool. But, you know, claiming that these people claiming that 95% of the population is a threat, they're the very ones who are the threat that they detest, because they're the ones seeking to go out and kill off the population. It's like, who's the threat to the population here? Those who actually want to go kill off all these people, you know, and think that they're better than everyone because of sophism, or those who are dumbed down intentionally because of them.
So if I hear you correctly, you're describing these people to have a loss of cause and effect in their thinking. Therefore, they're becoming irrational, and they have this philosophy which allows them to justifiably sin against the rest of us, like the rules.
Right, with their own ignorant philosophies that they put forth. And then the last thing I noticed was that Gatto misused the word liberal in his discussion of Spinoza. And the word liberal means of or befitting the free, and it comes from libro or liber or book, and is tied directly back to the seven liberal arts of the trivium and quadrivium.
I think in his defense he was using it sarcastically, because Spinoza is referred to as a quote-unquote liberal philosopher. But when you read his philosophy, the letters to the king, etc., there are some discrepancies, because he's basically giving the authorities a map to control people, and a map, according to Gatto, that has no way out. Like he's defined this entrapment system so that the kings and queens and the bankers can rule over all these other people. So that might have been sarcastic, but you are on to a point about this incoherence, justified sinning, the irrationality. What philosopher in particular, Jan, at the beginning of the 1800s in Prussia, had an everlasting effect on the philosophic corruption of our reality?
You must be talking about Kant.
Immanuel Kant.
Yes.
Can you tell us some more? What was his critique of reason all about?
Well, it's irrationality. It sent us into a modern dark age, basically, is what it did. It makes people think that they can't know anything, you know, and the early 19th century German philosophers have really done the world a disservice, especially Kant.
Well, I mean, Fichte takes his philosophy from Immanuel Kant. So when you have Fichte and Pestalozzi and all these other Prussian philosophers who then help von Clausewitz militarize Prussian society, you really can trace it all back to this philosophic corruption, meaning it is a corrupt method by which you can discern reality. It does not define that which exists, because it denies cause and effect. It denies proof. It denies logic and the use of objective means to attain these measures of knowledge. Rather, it makes knowledge based on the arbitrary, the unsubstantial. It takes away literally the knowledge of cause and effect that led through Newton's discoveries, right? So all of a sudden we go from logic-based, deductive, and inductive proofs to a hypothetical universe, that of Immanuel Kant, of David Hume, of so many of these people who dismiss objective reality, right? And yet if you tossed, you know, water at their face, they would duck or they would wipe it off, because there's cause and effect here in reality, right? So at the base, it's an irrational philosophy that is then led through the schooling system in not only Prussia, but America, Japan, all these other countries. And this is what has eaten away at the integrity of our own, you know, self-reign, Swaraj, they used to call it in India. It's our autonomy, our ability to be self-reliant. Let's go to Pennsylvania with Tony Myers. What are your thoughts, Tony?
Well, I thought Jan over there did a great job of covering some of the main points. I just want to make some references actually to what you said, Jan, especially in regards to population. It has been shown over time that in fact when a population is under stress, people tend to have more children because in fact their livelihoods are much more difficult. And over time, like you said, as the education goes up, as the standard of living goes up, people have much more ability to think about their situation, whether or not they, you know, they plan for the future as far as children are concerned. So population seems to decrease. So there's a complete contradiction anomaly there with what was presented back in the turn of the 20th century with Galton and Thomas Malthus, basically that there's no way to mathematically feed the poor. But then again, if you learn study the trivium and quadrivium, Well, trivial and specific, you come to understand that there's two types of number sets, ordinal and cardinal numbers. And you can use numbers just like you can, artists can paint a picture just about something they imagine. It doesn't have to actually pertain to reality. And I think that's something to remember and to keep in mind, that a lot of the numbers and statistics out there don't always correlate or pertain to or have an anchor back to reality. And I think it's important to maintain that important notion. Another thing I thought was really important that was noted. One is that Immanuel Kant, I believe, obviously with Pestalozzi and Wundt, is connected with the, you know, a philosophic group called the Illuminati, which I know Kevin knows much about as well as you do, Rich as well. So I know I was going through a bit of the, you sent me a timeline recently about the Illuminati, and I was going through that timeline late last night. I found it interesting, and I wasn't able to verify this, and I can always take this out if this isn't verifiable, but they said that the Rothschilds would actually interbreed with their first cousins or something. And that's something that seems to be a common practice among rich, elite, intellectual groups. And it seems to be reinforced here, once again, with what he was mentioning, basically with Charles Darwin. And what's interesting is that he basically outlines a history of irrational philosophies, utopias, and control systems. But it wasn't until Darwin that Darwin gave the scientific justification, whatever that means. Then we have to remember that science really is just a method. But at this time, it was starting to be held as the reigning supreme form of coming to know our reality, especially with the advancements made in electricity and obviously Newton's advancements in the 1700s or enough through. So it's extremely important that we keep in mind that it's just a method to come to know our reality. It's not necessarily something to take over. And unfortunately, philosophy has done a great deal to influence science. And it's obvious in what Darwin ended up doing, because pretty much instead of just like Gatto said there, you know, I hope people don't believe I've, you know, spun this fanciful tale here, but it's not like that at all. In fact, what he's showing is that there's all these patterns and there's all these connections, and you can actually, you know, you can see that there are these connections. You put the pieces together between all these different philosophies that lead up to this scientific quote unquote justification, or essentially an elite philosophy whereby which they want the ability to justify their, you know, rule over other people. And they do it. And unfortunately, it's really just repackaged philosophy for the modern times, which ended up being some type of scientific technocracy being put in place. And he goes more into that going forward. And yeah, I think that's about what I want to say for now.
No, I mean, those are some great points. And I think that Kevin would probably have a couple things to say about the interbreeding of the Galton, Wedgwood, Darwin family, because that's very well known that they have this practice, and that it's reinforced by the systems they create to uphold their establishment.
Well, exactly. And so what you're saying, or what you're recognizing, is that there's an ideology that has existed among the managerial class, the elite, the establishment, whatever you want to label it, that has existed for much longer than we have been taught.
Well, they just give it different justifications over time. Like Plato had these ideas. He gave it one set of justifications. Calvin and Spinoza come along, they give it these other different...
Well, and because they're the ruling class, they're the people who are printing whatever the mode of exchange is, the money of their day. They control the money of their day, they are controlling the resources, etc. And so what else are they controlling? Well, they're controlling the information also, right? And they're controlling, they're funding those philosophers who lend themselves to the already existing ideology that they have, whether it be Plato or Darwin or Malthus, etc. I mean, Malthus and Darwin have in common that they were both fellows of the Royal Society. So who is supporting and proliferating their work? Who's funding it?
And what is the Royal Society? What's that all about? I mean, it's an intelligence gathering network, and it's a bionomics agenda where they're going through and they're trying to lay down the law of life. They want to control life, whether it's Plato's version or the Anglican Church's version or Calvin's version or Spinoza or Darwin.
And dissenting opinions don't get funded. You don't see Godwin's response and refutation of Malthus being taught right next to Malthus, or not Malthus in school, but Darwin in school, right, et cetera. So you're not ever getting a full comprehensive perspective. You're getting one narrow, limited perspective.
Well, and when Malthus did the essay on population, which he did many different versions, again, this is from the footnotes, But he worked for the British East India Company College. His job was to train corporate employees to manage human resources, right? And never mind the fact that technology has allowed us to increase our food producing ability like 70-fold, right? We can grow 70 times more food on the same plot of land than we could 150 years ago. So there's technology that's being negated from Malthus's plan. And what it was at the end of the day, it's funded because it's propaganda from the British East India Company.
And their college is also known as Haileybury.
Haileybury.
That's a really good point about the ability to grow so much food on an acre of land today compared to the early 20th century, because it's gone up significantly, and now we have all of these new technologies coming in where they can stack going straight up on one piece of land and produce even more food from
it. Right. So the population problem is a myth if you look into it. The starvation problem comes from greed. No matter how many people you took off this planet, there would still be starving people because there would still be people with greed who take more than everyone else should let them take. Let's go to Paul Verge in Vancouver, Canada. What's going on, Paul? What do you think?
I was just going to say, I think Kevin's ready to speak, so I'll go right after him.
Yeah, I was just going to give a little bit of background. I think all of you have made excellent points based on what he's discussed here. I have a book here by R. Buckminster Fuller called A Posthumous Scenario for the Future of Humanity, called Cosmography. And in there, he has a chapter entitled Taking Inventory, and I'd just like to read a little bit of it for the listeners. Before the ascendancy of the British Empire, all previous empires in history, such as those of Alexander the Great or the Romans and that of Genghis Khan, were flat world empires. No one knew what went on beyond the map's borders. The British Empire, securely established in 1805 with the Great Sea Battle at Trafalgar, was the first empire in history on which, quote unquote, the sun never set. It was a spherical world empire and the result of a 200 years of daring conquest, scientific exploration, and economic treaties. It was through the mechanism of the British East India Company that, for the first time in history, a harvest of economic, scientific, and social information from around the spherical Earth was collected and digested. Thomas Malthus, when he became professor at the political economy at the East India Company College, realized that he was the first human being in all of history to have the vital statistics of humanity directly collected from all around a closed system spherical planet, as distinguished from an open system with its only logically significant economic data. Thomas Malthus proclaimed in 1803 that the global data showed humanity's population to be increasing at a geometric rate while its life support productivity was increasing only at an arithmetical rate. Based on this, he concluded something to this effect. Quite clearly, the majority of humans are destined to live out their years in great want, pain, and suffering. Pray all you want, it will do you no good. That sounds really familiar. That's all there is. Planet Earth has been scientifically established to be a closed system. Although Malthus's assumption has long been assumed by economists to be a generalized scientific law that an inherent fundamental inadequacy of life support exists on our planet, I saw as early as 1917 that technology provided an unexpected and adequate counter to his assumption and its later incarnations under general rubric limits to growth theories. So I think giving a little bit of background on this, he also goes on to say that his inventory of facts, in effect of a wealth of a highly classified information set belonging exclusively to those ambitious to run the world and reap its riches. Malthus's discoveries and conclusions remained popularly unknown through the first half of the 19th century. His findings were only of interest to those interested in winning control of the world's wealth away from its English-based masters, since and because Malthus's pronouncement of fundamental inadequacy of human life support on our planet. Each of the respective ideologists said then and still say, "You may not like our system, but we're convinced we have the fairest, most logical, most ingenious way of coping with the lethal inadequacy of life support on our planet. But because there are those who disagree on how to cope, it can only be resolved by a trial of arms, which system is fittest to survive." So it's interesting when you kind of look at the cultural environment there and the data set that they felt that they were privileged to, it explains the ideologies of this need for a balance or these ideas of management. And then, you know, later on, of course, this is where we get the Club of Rome and limits to growth and these population councils.
Right, because the whole eco-climate change movement is all run by the same eugenicists, and it's now the additional layer. It no longer ended with Calvin or the Anglican Church or Spinoza, et cetera. They've now added this new Al Gore layer, let's call it for now.
Well, let's
notice the underlying thing here is closed systems. That's all I need to say.
But, well, and what Bucky is describing is the same thing that Fletcher Prouty describes in his lecture, wherein he's talking about the perspective of the managerial class or the elite and the change in mentality from a flat world perspective to a spherical earth perspective, and that it created this fear of not having enough life support, this fear of lack. And the eugenics agenda comes from, the root cause is that fear of lack. And it's an irrational fear, but nonetheless.
Well, it's also greed on their part.
And, well, you know, and ironically, it's all by people who have the most of everything, the billionaires. So a couple of things I noticed while Kevin was reading that is that I had come across that same quote before, possibly in Grunch of Giants, also by Buckminster Fuller.
In Buckminster Fuller's universe, and there's another one. So it's all throughout his books. He's commenting on education and the environment.
Right. Lastly, I wanted to say that we also have to remember that the ecosystem itself has never been proved, and that is a scientific fabrication. And if people want to see All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace, that lays out the
Adam Curtis documentary.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And that, in what Kevin talks about, the closed systems, that's that theoretical development that led to essentially them, you know, taking that closed system, essentially that theory and applying it to computer systems and thinking that they could literally map out even like how a deer eats grass, for God's sakes. But like, that's what they were doing with us humans much earlier than that. And, this idea, and entropy, I think, was discovered by Boltzmann around that same time, if I said the name correctly. So, I mean, they all correlate to this kind of, you know, this theory of chaos and disorganization that then is presented through technology in the 20th century.
What do you think, Paul?
Well, they're trying to take that chaos and use revisionism to put it into order. And, you know, it's the whole thing is this theme of using deceptive rhetoric, right? But the acknowledgement is kind of underplayed that a lot of the deceptive rhetoric is self-deceptive rhetoric, and it requires, in order to, you know, justify in your own mind, you know, murdering millions of people, you have to come up with a pretty complicated lie to tell yourself. And that's what eugenics is, right? It's this rationalization for genocide in order to justify this fully controlled dystopia, utopia, whatever, however you want to look at it. But it's a reflection of the fact that these people become super rich, so then they're like, I have so much to lose. And because they have no one there to say no to them, they can fill themselves with their ideas and their friends' ideas who also have no one to say no to them. And these ideas are basically paranoid ideas of based on scarcity and loss. And because of that, they almost externally manifest that. Like, they're like, as long as I keep everyone else down, I'll be on top of things. And so, again, it represents this kind of paranoid worldview. And so I find it ironic that, you know, whenever a so-called conspiracy theorist confronts any of these elites on tape, accusing them of anything, they get dismissed as being like paranoid and everything. When it's clear, you can see in a lot of these people's eyes that they
and
are
in
clear.
Their writings.
Yeah. Of course, their whole thing is to play it down, right? The thing the elites treasure the most is control over your emotions, right? Don't lose your shit. And, you know, and then you can keep on, you can be like Donald Rumsfeld and lie to people's faces on camera and smile and laugh about it, right? Like, that's true psychopathy. But at the heart of that is this deep underlying fear and paranoia that they're going to be discovered, that they're going to be outed, essentially, because they're all living in the deception closet. So with the idea of revisionism and education with history, it's about pacifying your curiosity as to how reality's been built in the past by giving you this very surface level storybook version of history. And if you accept that and it makes sense and it's a good story, then you're like, I don't need to look there any further. And so when someone comes to you with a different version of reality and says, hey, you know, Darwin was actually a racist, eugenicist, Anglican, like, here's all these things that go against what you probably think.
Super wealthy.
Exactly. And this is the reason is because science and quote-unquote reason is this new religion. It's a new belief system designed to replace the old belief systems where instead of a priest, you turn to a white lab coat wearing guy and you have to trust him because he's a scientist. And it continually uses the appeal to expertise or appeal to authority fallacies because you essentially, everyone specialized in these different scientific fields aren't really qualified to cross-criticize all these other scientific fields unless they've supposedly trained in them. But if you have the trivium, you can kind of get a basic understanding of, you know, and the quadrivium especially, you can get a basic understanding of just about any scientific field, right? You can learn physics and chemistry and biology and all these things in high school, and you're not necessarily going to be a doctor, a physicist, or a chemist, but you could read a paper by somebody and kind of understand what it means, right?
And well, if you use the trivium method, you'd understand how they all integrate, and you'd have a comprehensive understanding.
And that's the important thing, is having the full umbrella comprehensive understanding and seeing how these things interrelate. Science is like a religion where instead of having the Seventh-day Adventists, the Catholics, the Christians, and all these different splinter groups, they have these different specialties. And they're kind of like, well, we don't want to look at each other's specialties. We want to stay compartmentalized. Because
that's
then we
the
don't
Russian PhD system, is to keep them compartmentalized.
In the scientific community, in quotes, becomes the feedback loop to yes. perpetuate that status quo.
Because that's how they give out a PhD, is you have to support some other PhD's existing thesis, because it's part of the infrastructure you're helping to build, but you don't understand that when you pay for it.
Well, what that does is reinforces the self-deception, because then without having these other groups being able to check and balance each other's work, people can take their work in these extreme directions without like MK Ultra style stuff, right? Where the government, the taxpayer dollars are funding essentially torture experiments to find out what effects they have on the mind and the personality. And that's because somebody doesn't have the checks and balances to say, wait a second, you know, that's ridiculous.
Well, and because the school system is pumping out secondhand thinkers who capitulate to authority figures, etc., and have provisional self-esteem, etc., then even the general public can't be the balance. They can't be the check. They, you know what I'm saying? So they're accepting all of these authority figures, and there's no checks and balances
because
within
public
the system.
School makes
They've
sure
all been
no
removed.
Checks and balances.
Right.
So I've got a mathematical formula here that says self-deception plus lack of critical thinking equals willful ignorance, right? And that willful ignorance is the cause of irrationality. If you're intentionally ignoring facts, that would change the way you think so that you can stay in a comfortable bubble, or not even comfortable. So people just attach to a bubble of reality. And it's even when it becomes uncomfortable, just because they've been with it for so long, they don't want to give up on it. And that causes this irrational defense mechanisms and all these slides past critical thinking. But the effect of that cause is the perpetuation of these hollowed out systems that aren't very well thought out, that continually go off in these directions that are ridiculous and waste resources and result in destruction, and they're destined to collapse. So my last point would be, if these eugenicists, you know, bloodlines are so genetically superior to all of us naturally, whether they come from space aliens or the line of Jesus, or they're just, you know, those top white people supposedly.
Or the line of Moses for that matter.
Yeah. Whatever they've deluded themselves into believing. If that's true, then why do they have to send their kids to these special schools to get special educations and spend billions of dollars to dumb the rest of us down with it, public education and propaganda?
Exactly,
dude.
Where are these? Right,
so I was just going to say, I'll go over the notes I have here for the first 15 minutes, and you guys can interrupt me if you so desire. He talks about, he brings back in Plato, Spinoza, Calvin, Fichte. He's talking about Charles Darwin coming from an Anglican family and the descent of man. The evolutionarily retarded are fatally dangerous to the physical integrity of the human race. Nobody questions that. He says that 90% of us are fatally retarded and irrational. Spinoza says we're all irrational, like hopelessly irrational. How can such a small percent call the rest of us irrational when we are, if we are irrational as a population, it's because of the public schooling system that they had to put there in the first place. Because why would they have to put it there in the first place? Because we were also rational and commonsensical in the first place. Otherwise, they wouldn't need to roll out compulsory school. That's what Gatto was talking about in those first couple lines, to my understanding. The justified sinners, this whole idea that whether it's Plato or the Anglican Book of Common Prayer or Darwin, they're all kind of saying the same thing. And what is the Anglican Book of Common Prayer? The Anglican religion was artificially created by who? Henry VIII? And it was voted on, and it was basically an adaptation of the Vatican control system that would then give direct power to the king instead of to the Pope. So that was a clever idea on the part of Henry VIII. Then he gets into the Darwin, Wedgwood, Galton family. Then this is the whole idea of eugenics that rears its ugly head. It's been going on since Plato, but now they've written out formulas. They've written books on it. They start the they start going vaccinations in the 1600s, in the 1700s, in the 1800s.
Let me just interject something real quick, Rich.
Go ahead.
I mentioned Kevin and Nat up in BC, up in Vancouver earlier. This was in large part the Anglican Church that was committing the genocide up there, including Catholic and others, but Anglican Church was one of the primary offenders.
Anglican is just it's a Latin word that means English. So it just means English Church, Church of England, this sort of idea. They call it Anglican because it sounds more a little, you know, official, and it sounds more separated from the King of England, I guess. So this idea of eugenics, right? I was just watching Clint Richardson's new movie, Lethal Injection, The Origins of Vaccination. And about 45 minutes to an hour and a half, there's a fascinating part in there that gives you the history of vaccinations and when they started being used. And what you find out is that a lot of the diseases that were supposed to be vaccinated for declined shortly before they introduced these vaccinations. So it's like a false positive that they're claiming, if you look at the history. So this is all part of the eugenics program, whether it's amending us and adjusting us through school, or amending us and adjusting us through vaccinations, or amending us and just – they're treating us like farm animals. And when you look at the studies that they're doing on animals and juxtapose that to the studies they're doing on people, the reason that they're studying the animals in all these cases are to learn how to better control the human species. This starts with Origin of Species, continues on through the descent of man. I know that we looked up the origins of a lot of these elite private boarding schools. There was more than six in existence prior to Descent of Man, but I'm not sure which of those pre-existing ones are really elite boarding schools as opposed to some sort of church boarding school, private institution, those sort of things. But then he makes that comment, now the cap is off the tunnel to hell. And he's talking about the justified sinners who have run on unchecked because we have lost the ability to intellectually defend ourselves in school. And now we have this new version of it, whether you want to call it bionomics, which is the control of life by law, or this new eco-climate change movement, which justifiably sins and murders people all over the world, introducing toxicity and all sorts of other crazy things to make more money for the companies that are ruining this planet. It's not the individuals. We're not the ones choosing to put all these crazy things in our light bulbs. These old light bulbs work fine for us, right? But these new eco-friendly light bulbs, if you break one, there's an EPA cleanup sheet. You have to basically clear your house. It's crazy. So it isn't that Gatto has spun off this wacky theory. He's providing us with this wonderfully rich fabric of foundation that is, as he says, is our birthright. He's connecting the dots, and he's trying to point out these things that exist. They're laying all over the place, but the status quo isn't going to pay anybody to point all this stuff out to us when they spend so much money into making us incoherent in the first place. They don't want us making these points. And then at the last point, he brings up Wilhelm Wundt, who's a Prussian psychotherapist and the premier behavioral psychologist, but he's also the creator of the PhD system, and he also believes that children have no soul. And that, if you look at the footnotes from the video, I know it's called The Leipzig Connection, Basics in Education by Paolo Leone. And there are several places in there where it just breaks down the Yale Troika, who came together to corrupt American education with the Prussian influence, also describes Wundt and his evolution, and then his apprentices like G. Stanley Hall and these other characters who bring the PhD back to America. He talks about, not by name, but he's referring to Edward Everett, who was the first PhD candidate, I believe 1818, and he was also later governor of Massachusetts. So the infestation of this control philosophy within the leaders of our society, creating these false experts, people who aren't really comprehensively educated, people who aren't looking out for your best interests, but rather are acting as part of a plan to indoctrinate, condition, control, manipulate, confuse, frustrate, and make the rest of us aggressive. And there is a way to think our way out of this, but we first have to recognize the facts that are easily attainable to connect these things so we can have a basic understanding of what's going on. And from what I see so far, the school system's corrupt, and then we ask the question, is it corrupt intentionally? Yes, it has been corrupted intentionally, and now we're answering the question why, And now we see that there's a few thousand years of a plan that's been going on that these different guys have helped develop, control the 90% of us who make up the public, because the 10% of them consider themselves to be justified sinners, to be created by God to manage the rest of us like animals. And I just think there's a better way. So what we're going to do is listen to the next 15 minutes of hour two of the Ultimate History Lesson, A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto, and then we'll be right back.
Not because they have a PhD degree are they made presidents of universities, heads of government bureaus, because their families have clout. And now that's become the ticket to intellectual management. That's how these Prussian ideas spread like wildfire. There's only one university in the United States who doesn't have a president with a Prussian PhD, and he's close. I think he has a French PhD, because the French scrambled to try to get that degree too. That's Titchener at Cornell, or the head of all the heads of psych departments, Prussian PhDs. So you now get this kernel of ideas, whether fanciful or scientific, everywhere. From Japan, I mean, everywhere the same idea. The Japanese Constitution in 1868 is scrapped, and the Prussian Constitution translated into Japanese. I mean, we're talking here the domination of ideas that's so interesting that what should make you suspicious is that no one ever heard of it. They heard of this detail. Why hasn't anyone joined them together? Well, I'll tell you what. A big shot professor at Columbia Teachers College told me 12 years ago when I bearded him in his den, and I said, Doug, surely you know these things. Why is a junior high school teacher left to beat the drum? He looked at me and he said, not a good way to get tenure. That's all he said, and I knew that financial finally prize or penalty is enough to control the way we all think. And these things have been studied since the collegia in ancient Rome. Armies have put together these insights. Churches have put together these insights and passed them down in an unbroken string to their sons, usually, and of course the daughters catch as catch can, but eventually to both.
If I could notice the pattern that you're describing, it seems that people are irrational. They come up with ideas of utopias, and then they, in order to get this utopia, compulsory schooling. And then they found a bunch of different ways, in the latest using science, to make people think that this is how it has to be. But when you look at the real effects of Darwin in the form of, say, eugenics and the role it played in America.
That's Galton is the inventor. His first cousin is the inventor of eugenics and the chief global distributor. There's one major exception to this, and the people who claim to be a follower of the exception claim to have read his book like the Bible, have never seen him say what I'm about to say. I'm talking about the so-called father of capitalism, the wealth of nations, Adam Smith, who in the first 15 pages says there's no difference between the Duke's son and the street sweeper's son, except early training. A dead giveaway that this idea was known to be highly dangerous, and I don't think this has ever occurred in publishing that I know of before or since. In the 1889 reprint of Wealth of Nations, because it immediately became an international must-read. The publisher of the book, a man with the ironic name of William Playfair, an economist, takes his own author to task in the preface to the book. He said the social order would be destroyed by telling people that they were all capable of intellectual development. The only way we progress through thousands of years of history is to make them think they depend on our goodwill, you know, for their bread and butter, let alone their safety and everything else. It's a scathing upbraid of his own immortal author, Adam Smith. But Smith is, as far as I can see, other than minor figures like Florence Nightingale, and I'm not even sure about her, he's the only one who says what ought to be obvious on the face of it. Became obvious to me when I was given 5 classes a day to teach in the middle of Manhattan's Gold Coast of the Upper West Side. So I taught the sons and daughters of the media darlings and the sons and daughters of the professoriate and the doctors and lawyers, but I also taught the kids from Spanish Harlem and from Black Harlem who'd never eaten off a tablecloth in their life. Nor was I raised with a very democratic outlook. It wasn't an undemocratic outlook, but it wasn't stressed. So you could hardly call my family, in modern terms, liberal, although I hope we'll discuss that's not a dirty word at all. It's what you ought to be aiming to be. And because my German grandfather, who cried out in the middle of the street in Mon City for German victory during the Second World War, even though his son was an infantry commander at the Battle of the Bulge, but he was calling for German victory. Let me see if I can tone down my enthusiasm for
well, a large percentage of the population at the time was German.
Oh, right now.
There was a whole swing of, you know, pro-German up until like 1913, and then all of a sudden the Germans were Huns and ad hominem attacks, right.
Adolf Hitler, the reason you don't find Mein Kampf everywhere isn't that it's a dull book. There's a center section that's a tribute to the United States as the most pure Germanic country on earth. The 10-foot portrait of Henry Ford behind Hitler's desk, and Sigmund Freud's nephew,
Bernays.
Edward L. Bernays, was the public relations man for Nazi Germany. That's why you don't find that would disturb people to know. So best they don't know that stuff. Anyway, I partly out of a kind of natural egalitarianism that comes from a strong working class population around Pittsburgh who will break your nose if you insult them rather than beg for mercy. And partly because of laziness, I decided with my 5 classes a day to impose the same material on all 5 classes, the same quality of discourse, make no differentiation at all. Certainly made my life easier. But what I had done was throw away the assigned curriculum, which I believe was Jack London, and nothing wrong with Jack London. A lot of fun to read. But if you want to exercise your mental muscles, that's not the way to go. And I had taken from Cornell and Columbia and Reed College in Oregon, which are the major colleges I attended, I had taken a level of text fully equal to that. And what I discovered was, apart from cosmetic differences, maybe a little less grammatical, maybe shorter papers and stuff, that the level of intellect in the ghetto black population and the ghetto Hispanic population was really quite equal to the others. That wasn't a political belief I wanted to impose. Let me give you one example. I had a little black kid named Gregory Smith. Gregory, I hope somehow or other you're alive and you're listening to this. And I'm replacing Jack London with Moby Dick, the most difficult American novel ever written that explores all the great ideas of European history, predestination, and all the rest. And I'm holding forth on those ideas at the same time we're reading a book that's way beyond anything in difficulty they've ever read. And I hear a crash. I look, and Gregory Smith has fallen asleep and crashed to the floor. Well, I'm fresh out of Pittsburgh. And the way we deal with people like that is to kick them with the soles of their feet. They wake up real quick. That's the way the cops do to us when we're making out under cars around Pittsburgh. And if our feet stick out, they kick our feet. So anyway, Gregory wakes up, and I'm very insulting, and he said, I don't need to pay attention. I learned that stuff in third grade. We're in eighth grade now. So I'm really insulting, but I say, what do you mean you learned that in third grade? He said, well, I learned that there are these sets of ladies who weave your future and you can't change it. Either the Norns in Scandinavia or the Fates in Greece. And as I was reeling back from that, because he'd made a connection Cornell and Columbia never made for me, between predestination and these, he said, and I learned these things from the visiting science teacher called genes and chromosomes, and they dictate the color of your hair and how you scratch your nose. You can't change that. So I don't need to listen to you talk about predestination. Well, at that minute, I mean, at that exact second, I said, this kid has written a PhD thesis that'll become a book, you know, that'll make his living for the rest of his life. And he's Gregory Smith, a stupid kid. You know, and then I completely opened my eyes. And sure enough, behind the street idiom was active mentality, you know, fresh ideas. It just had been treated with such disrespect for so many years, it wasn't worth bothering to waste it on a school teacher. It revolutionized my teaching. But then over the balance of the, that was the first year I taught, of the 29 years I taught, I decided to use the fresh eyes and perspectives of the so-called hopeless ghetto kids. And huge benefits flowed to me, and I hope some to them too, because I took what they wanted to do seriously. If Jamal Watson wanted to do nothing but draw comic books in the back of the class, I would go back and use my superior experience, not intelligence, to say, listen, Jamal, I used to read comic books. And if you want to do this seriously, you're doing it wrong. And he'd get angry. He'd say, I'm the best in the school. I said, yeah, maybe, I said. But in a real comic book, all the panels aren't the same size. Look at the one you're copying from. They're all different sizes to show movement. And in a real comic book, the figures don't stay inside of the body. The head comes out, the fist comes out. I said, look, you're copying and you don't see that. Why don't you take a week out of school, go to the local public library, I'll cover for you. Take down a stack of books on graphic art and learn what you're doing. I mean, that's a worthwhile use of your time. So I found out that each person, one girl wanted to do nothing but swim, and she snored in class. And when I finally said to her, what's going on? She said, I've devoted my life to being an Olympic swimmer. She's 13. And I said, well, why don't you do that for the rest of the year? You can't do it in school. We don't have a swimming pool. But there are about 150 public swimming pools in New York City. Why don't you plot them out on a map with pins or stickers, visit every one of them, set up a rating for these swimming pools, concentration of chemicals in the water, depth of the pool, length of the lane, lighting, access, cost, and you will produce an information reference that'll make you somebody, because I'll go around to the local public library and say you're doing that, and could you be cataloged? Because who else has such a reference as this? Well, she was. Her life was transformed because I treated her time and her with respect. But meanwhile, if you took any of the subject areas, you could find that she was developing muscles in each one of them.
Welcome back to Peace Revolution, episode 42. That was the second hour of the Ultimate History Lesson, a weekend with John Taylor Gatto, minutes 15 through 30. We covered quite a lot in there. I think it's a little bit more manageable because some of the points that he was making continued to overlap. I started to pick up on a pattern of that which he had learned through his 29 years of experience, and I think it's all finally starting to come together after an hour and a half. Now we are starting to see him build out a comprehensive picture in order over these coming hours. You'll continue to get it in its crescendo in hour five. I feel it starts to all really gel right there when he blends it back to his actual teaching experiences in New York City, telling us that from his experience, even though the school system, the society, everyone wants to think about these kids as differently able or differently capacitated, they all have equal capacity. They have equal potential. Only some of these kids, it's being fostered, and in other kids, it's being suppressed.
What I hear him describing is a system of intellectual management that is our compulsory school system that came from the Prussian PhDs. And it's necessary because the managerial class's social order would be destroyed if the people figured out that they were equal and just as capable, etc. If, as Adam Smith said, there's no difference between the Duke's son and the street sweeper's son except early training, these ideas, if they were loose among the people, Gatto sees the proof in Gregory Smith, who in eighth grade has written a PhD thesis, you know, that he started thinking about in third grade. And so if the social status of the managerial class would be destroyed, so they have to have a system of compulsory school to intellectually manage the 99%, the masses, what have you. Well, everybody else.
That's what he confirms for himself when he corners Doug, the Columbia professor, and says, you know, Doug, why is a junior high school teacher left to beat the drum and do this research and figure this out for himself? Like, isn't this known at your level? And Doug replies, not a good way to get tenure. And so I looked up the definition of tenure. And tenure is basically a guarantee of employment, but it's only given out after you've sufficiently rewarded the system that created tenure. And when you look into the origins of tenure, as the footnotes will show you, It's created by the Rockefellers and all the robber baron families. And so if they set up the education board and they set up the teachers' pensions and tenure and these guarantees, they have total control. And that's what Gatto realizes. It's that financial reward. It's that dangling carrot that keeps them all in line, that allows them to lie to children when the facts are out there, but they're not going to be assembled and organized and presented to you in a coherent way through a system which is intentionally designed to break your curiosity, to interrupt your coherence, to basically usurp your free will, and to send you in a direction that is not of your own volition, but is in the benefit of a predator. And I don't see why after generation, we have to let this go on anymore when we have these tools, especially this interview set, at our disposal to put out everywhere and to get to everybody.
Absolutely. I think it's interesting. Buckminster Fuller spent his life trying to dispel Malthus's proclamations. Kind of Gatto's importance for me is best illustrated in that his journey and his life's work really is all about dispelling the myth of the favored races perpetuated by Galton and Darwin. And this part, you know, kind of sums up how he came to terms with these insights and what he decided to do about it. And I think that's what's key to understanding his individual motivation. Treating kids with respect, taking them seriously, enabling them with their natural learning processes and therefore their curiosity. I think those are all very instrumental in understanding where he's coming from here and how this revolutionized his teaching and what he decided to do with it until the breaking point, until it could no longer stand up against the scrutiny of what they wanted him to teach.
Well, there's this other idea beyond the Prussian PhD system that is there to create these artificial experts to controlling our energy policy, our foreign policy, our domestic policy, anything that you see on TV. A lot of these people have these PhD degrees. They are presented to us as authorities or experts. But what Gatto is saying is that if you actually go out and look, you have an unbroken chain of crowd control, of how to control the masses, that comes from the Roman Collegia. Did anyone look up the Roman Collegia? That was a group of entrepreneurs, gangsters, criminals, all sorts of people back in Rome who basically had refined the arts of crowd control. This then rolled out through different churches. This then was used by armies over time. This has been used for thousands of years. And he's, you know, observing this for himself, finding this for himself, and really finding the cognitive dissonance that comes from being there in front of these facts and then also standing there with your public education in your hand. You're like, what do I believe? Do I believe this conditioning that was given to people, you know, given to me by people who weren't necessarily, you know, there to help me develop as an individual? They were there to get a job done, to condition us, to make us into interchangeable parts, right? Or you can look at these primary sources and actually look at it for yourself, and you see a very different story being told through the artifacts of history than what is being presented. So I think his description of how he has approached this cognitive dissonance, and then he's also blending it with his experience of noting that except for early training, there's no difference between these kids. And if you instill upon them an advanced curriculum, the level of intellect is quite equal to those kids that he's teaching on the Upper West Side, right? And so when he understands that the stupid kid in his mind is actually the really, really smart kid, probably smarter than the teacher in some respects, that is a revolution, a turnaround in the mind, a turnaround in your perspective, where you literally go 360 degrees. He turned his head all the way around, turned his body all the way around in a full circle, and is now looking at the world from a full perspective instead of just this limited one that he had been given. That's when his world, you know, got huge that day, making those realizations. So that these are the processes by which he comes to later resign, because he's learning bit by bit through experience. And in most of the stories he tells, a lot of the great ones, come from his first year, because I think that's when he was really breaking through in his mind and overcoming these early paradigms that were kind of conditioned into us. But the idea of being able to transform people's lives through these little experiences, whether it's giving a kid some responsibility and you're going out and you're defining some sort of new information that adults haven't even had. I mean, he tells several stories during the interview where kids in high school are developing some sort of data set or organized data structure that is valuable to adults and a higher quality than that is being produced, whether it's the statistical polling or some of these other projects that he mentions. It's fascinating how the people that run this world could see it benefiting them, because that's why they're doing these things. They think it benefits them. I don't see how it benefits them to dumb the rest of us down, because you're basically breaking all the inventive ways of solving these problems that we need, and therefore, like, the people running the place are destroying themselves. It's like they have a death wish or something, but I guess that comes with the psychopathy.
I found it interesting that I'd seen that all these Prussian PhDs were the heads of psych departments. As a comment he made in the beginning, and, you know, what came out of that was essentially the all these different types of studies, like, you know, the psychometrics, which, you know, Gatto mentioned, study shades of qualities, and what, you know, came out with all these compartmentalizations, which were, you know, rolled out in society, and all these different competitions and things and rankings and grades and so forth and so on, frustration, aggression studies, Milgram, Pavlov, all these different things kind of, you know, were born out of those psychometrics. So it's just interesting. It's like Prussian PhDs all ties back to Germany and these corrupted philosophic ideals. And I think that's important to maintain that connection.
Well, and I also, it's also the way you described it. I just want to make sure we're clear. It wasn't that the Prussian PhDs came in and took over the psychology departments.
That's not why
they were the heads.
They were a useful tool.
They brought it with them. Wundt was the premier psychotherapist of his time. It was all about behavioral psychology. And the question is, what does behavioral psychology have to do with educating children? What about, like, George Washington? Let's go back to a famous, you know, founding father example that everyone can relate to, right? George Washington. What type of special adjustments did he need from external sources in order to grow up to be who he was, right? No, he wasn't put through an official, like, public school system, university system. He didn't get a high school degree. He didn't get a marriage license. How did the people back in the founding of this country ever function without all these layers of bureaucracy that are irrational? Or could that be the root cause of the problem? We only let these irrational layers of bureaucracy build up when people don't have intellectual self-defense to ask a couple questions that stifle the opposition. They don't know why they're doing this. They just do it because everyone else is letting them act crazy.
Something that I wanted to add really quick to that, I was just reading earlier about Sigmund Freud and his basing much of modern psychology on the Kabbalah.
Well, that would fit in because all of the Western mystery schools are based at its heart at Kabbalah. And Kabbalah isn't something that was created in ancient Middle Eastern times. That's just where the current version that's called the Kabbalah was codified and written down in a special structure. It existed back in India. It existed back in China. This knowledge is ancient. It predates all of the artifacts that we have been presented as public school history. And so there is a useful code that has been used by a predatory class that gives them clarity, that gives them certainty. And it's only predatory because they occult it. They hide it. They keep it. They keep useful secrets to themselves and let the rest of us wander around. It will be akin to a group of people who are predators having a compass and an accurate map, and the rest of us are still out there just chasing our tail. When these tools exist and we could have them for ourselves to likewise navigate with certainty and not to fall into the pitfalls. But their job is to keep us confused and to put a magnet beside our compass if we get one, right? And that would be the example of using critical thinking, of using logic, without first defining what exists through percepts in your five senses and concepts in your mind. What is knowledge, right? If you don't have those two steps, you have a compass, but there's a magnet beside it, and it's not going to give you true north, and you're not going to be able to navigate consistently. So as long as they deny us these useful tools, these methods of attaining certainty, of discerning fact from fiction, of telling when somebody of a predatory class, A, is a predator, and B, how and when they're lying to you, right? Because they control us by giving us inaccurate information. And so if you have a filter that defends yourself against that, then you are much better prepared to survive and plan for the future.
And what is the Kabbalah but just a psychological roadmap, and then just kind of, you know, develop? And so when understood that way, understanding then what was done through social sciences and psychology when it was developed, it's really not that different trying to test out and understand human nature or try to define it the way they want to so they can control people. So, and it's really just a different philosophy, different times, but kind of the same idea. But, you know, one of the beautiful things I love about Gatto's stories he tells about his own awakening, but also, you know, watching these children and realizing how intelligent they are. He mentions later on, like, how we're biologically equipped. You know, he just doesn't understand why we treat our children this way. It's, you know, it really goes to the analogy of what they essentially had to do to us was they painted this picture and then put us in this picture. And without, if they allow us to paint our own pictures, allow us to with just go through real life experience, like he allowed his students to go through. They ended up all of a sudden doing much better in school, much better in class, just because they were front loaded with this experience, which gave them just that, I guess, that feeling of not being a kid anymore, but at being an adult.
Well, I think he set the expectations. He set the expectations that he's not going to assert his control over them. If they are able to act responsibly, they can have this cooperative relationship. And what you have through time is people, there's a small group of people who has always wanted to assert their will over the rest of us and control a larger percent. And I think not only is that irrational, proof positive as it exists in reality, that is provable by logic, but it's also a sign of immaturity. Because I think when you want to take away the volition of someone else in order to get what you want, you have not yet learned to control yourself. And therefore, you have no right. No one has a right to violate the volition of other beings. But the more that that is lost among the population, the more it can go on. So in order to restore freedom and liberty and all these sort of things that are nebulous terms that are thrown around by people who occupy Wall Street, if you understand the problem as it exists in reality, you then know the solution.
We're really experiencing the sort of the fourth generation of the slave control operating system. So this modern education system is kind of like the newest, the Windows 7 version of slave OS. The first three would be, you know, the Egyptian physical force slavery, which led to eventually the Roman servant class kind of slavery, where you would, instead of putting all the slaves together, you would house them with you. And then that led to the serfdom, which was, you know, giving the peasants their own plot of land. And each one of these types of slavery increases the productivity of the servant class or the slave class, right? Because they feel a little bit more free, they're a little bit more happy. And so what we have now is we're educated to be content with what we have, you know, be thankful and be happy. And that's great, but the problem is that the people who are the social engineers have become so brazen and so irrational in their theft and robbery, the corruption's become so rampant, that they're no longer able to maintain the illusion of comfort for an increasing number of people, and that's what's waking people up. That's why something like Occupy Wall Street's even happening, right? People's comfort has been disrupted, and they're angry about it. So it's like there are a lot of educated people, I'm sure, that would participate in something like that, for what it symbolizes, but you'll have a lot of just dumb, angry groups of people as well. And I say dumb in terms of just like they're ignorant of the whole depth of the situation. They're not actually dumb people. They just don't have the full gravity of all these levels of what's going on, right? I also wanted to touch on this idea of classification of children. We have this one size fits all uniform education system that then labels other kids as these are the disabled ones, these are the geniuses, these are the savants, these are the idiot savants. And instead of connecting or engaging with these kids, they either punish them, marginalize them, or put them on psychotropic drugs, and so that none of them reach their full potential, when what Gatto saw was that, no, you just need to tailor a curriculum to each child, because each child is unique, right? And from that viewpoint, you then realize it's irrational to have a uniform education system. And so if so much money is put into trying to repair this obviously flawed and broken system from the outset, then it must be a purposeful thing. It must be, you know, it's not just accidental that we're being dumbed down, that the education quality level is dropping. It's by design and it's purposeful, right? You can no longer make the argument that it's accidental. People are doing their best in their positions wherever they are. You know, even teachers are doing their best many times. They don't know any better. But the system is designed to fail on purpose, or to at least put out these kids who won't be able to fight back against it. I was also going to mention that this idea of benefits, the education system is supposed to benefit us by giving us these skills. It does give, you know, the basic ideas of reading and writing and all that stuff, but without the critical thinking, you know, if they're giving your kid a laptop as a benefit, and that laptop has a webcam on it, and they can log in and privately watch your kids and see what they're doing, which has happened, it's documented in the news.
Are you talking about Google Chrome? Oh, you're talking about the schools.
The school board themselves.
There's multiple ways that they're actually preying on your kids, whether it's the browser or the school. I mean, who has this interest into taking a look at children like that?
Well, it begs the question, unfortunately. And then the last thing I was going to mention was the idea of behavioral psychology, the kind of codification of that as an operating system. You know, it's taking all these things that they've learned for thousands of years beforehand, right? The kind of, you know, how to have an efficient slave on your farm plantation, or however you want to look at it, and how to get the maximum efficiency from them. With behavioral psychology, it was like, okay, now we have a new coding language to seed this idea of persuasive propaganda, right? Propaganda that people won't even realize is propaganda, because we'll keep them at such an artificially low level of critical thinking. They'll just, if everyone else is saying it, they'll just believe it's true. Otherwise, everyone else wouldn't be saying it. And it really comes down to something that simple, right?
Or even at a medium level of critical thinking, people who have university degrees, who have a good sense of logic, if they have a corrupt data set that they're referring to as far as public school history that we've been taught, yeah, your logic is going to still add up to the irrational status quo situation, because that's how they've bent everything through the education system, so that when you grow up to be a corporate employee, you are best trained to do that situation and that situation only. They don't want you free thinking or discovering that they're laundering money through these accounts or doing any of the things that, you know, get people out of the corporate system. If you want to get out, the quickest way is to figure out what's really going on and try to do something about it. They'll kick you out right away. And the system is designed. That's its immune system. When you blow the whistle, you're actually warning the people who are preying on everyone else that, oh, okay, we can get rid of this leaky person here who wants to do the right thing and treat people the right way. So they condition everybody to just go along with it. It's the Amtssprache fallacy, where someone else can be responsible for your actions, that because you're being told to do it by your boss or your commander or whatever, that you are under orders. You're under control of somebody else. You have outsourced your thinking. That is the height of human irresponsibility, and nobody can be responsible for your actions but you. So that's a fallacy in your thinking to believe that someone else could be responsible for your actions. But the historical data set that we're given is that if you outsource your thinking and you become under the control of somebody else, you're a hero. They'll name streets after you. They'll give you medals. They'll do all these special things. But you know what they won't do? They won't take care of you healthcare-wise after you serve the country, will they? They won't recognize the first responders and the other people who have gone out and risked their lives either. So we see out one side of their mouth, they're saying these people are heroes, but when you actually compare their words to their actions, you find the hypocrisy that is the root cause of this incoherence. And whether it's Occupy Wall Street or Occupy the Fed or what have you, end the Fed, any of these sort of things, the root cause is that the educational level, the critical thinking level of recognizing reality and being able to communicate of the general population has been taken away. That's why all these symptoms are around. And as long as we keep rallying against the symptoms, hoping that the system will just learn and do the right thing, I think that we continue to repeat these vicious and costly and fatal patterns of history. But if we can, for the first time, just recognize the root cause, that we all have a responsibility to have intellectual self-defense, and that we don't have it as a function of the public school system, and that if we don't get it for ourselves now, we are going to continue to outsource our thinking to be stimulus reaction machines that they have formulas to control. The way to get outside of their control is to by literally thinking outside of their box, being outside of the program that they wrote to control and manipulate you. But every time we type into Facebook or Google or any of these other things, we help them build a map of our behavior, of our personality, better than we possibly understand ourselves. And I think we have to start asking the question, who is funding these things? For what purpose are they being done? And why can somebody who runs a billion-dollar company like Facebook say that his users are dumb fuckers? Pardon my language, but that's his quote. So I don't understand why people continue to play into a system that preys on them, unless they are so incoherent that they can no longer identify their predators. And that spells the end of the human species as we see it, because what's going to be left is a very unhuman corporate species that preserves itself at the cost of human lives. And I don't see why we have to let it go on like that. But I digress.
I was just going to close off my thought with saying that in trying to figure out how the human mind works, these irrational, mostly, psychotherapists have identified our perceived flaws and weaknesses and have used this information that they've kept to themselves mostly, to socially engineer this class of comfortable consumer slaves.
Well, isn't it the same psycho, the rapists, who are drugging our kids in public schools now and mandating that they be dumbed down, and if you have too much input and you're getting too much stimulus, they want to give you Prozac or Zoloft or Ritalin or any of these other things because you're too curious, and school's job is to break that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the thing is that they've gotten so brazen and so irrational in so many directions that in a way it's getting us uncomfortable. It's shaking us out of our kind of comfort zone, and you'll have a shrinking number of people who are willing to take more crap and become and live less human. But I think the positive effect of something like the Occupy movement or End the Fed or whatever is at least that's five layers deeper than saying some other protest or some other idea. They're getting closer to the truth, not further away, in my opinion. And so that's an indication of more people waking up, but they just have a little deeper to go. And so when you have a group like that, yeah, they're going to get redirected and infiltrated, and all movements usually have that happen, right? But the point is that as an individual, you can go to one of those events and just strike up conversation with other people around you and on a one-on-one basis, fill in their blind spots and help everyone raise each other up to a level where we all do get deeper than just Occupy this and End the Fed. And we start realizing it's about taking responsibility and getting people to learn, you know, some form of trivium education and discover that it's ourselves that we need to fix first. And then when we come together again, instead of it being like a disjointed, you know, 16 different agendas movement, it's like everyone's focused on the one thing or two or three things that are the key things, which is, you know, this system of elites, essentially, whether they're bankers or masons, or it's a mentality. It's they're it crosses too many backgrounds to make the backgrounds important. It's the mentality, the core ideology that unites all these things, and that is, we have more information than you, so we're better than you. And that's it. And we have to figure out the lies, this web of lies that's been placed around us, and figure our way out of it and alert each other, wake each other up to it as efficiently and compassionately as possible before they target us eugenically and say, you know, the class who isn't millionaire or billionaire all need to go. And they turn the millionaires into the servant class and the billionaires rule. You know what I mean? I don't want a future like that. So I just have a lot of hope.
I would agree that any of these movements of solidarity that's a good start. But
it's an indicator.
The test is, once they encounter resistance, will they learn and will they adapt and will they continue to do the research that's necessary to actually get to the root causes and get to the roots instead of trying to battle the branches on the tree that are being fed by the stalk of the tree and the roots? You know, I'm just saying, let's apply common sense to that.
One thing people can do if they're, you know, they're looking to find some evidence of this throughout history would be perhaps to look up an individual by the name of James Roland Angell, or Angel, who was the president of Yale University. He was also the president of the Carnegie Foundation and an educational counselor with NBC. He earned his master's degree under John Dewey, and as a professor at the University of Chicago, one of his most famous students turned out to be John B. Watson, who, of course, we know from history is responsible for the behaviorism studies, Little Albert, giving a lot of the credit later on, of course, to B.F. Skinner for behaviorism. But this individual, James Roland Angell, is particularly interesting because he is in charge of the Yale Institute of Human Relations, which was seeking to bring in a lot of these Prussian PhDs and those that were learning this new Prussian psychology and bring that into a systems theory, an interdisciplinary theory, where they would put psychology in the middle and have basically a society in a box surrounding that. And they would use that as a way to try to fill in the gaps of these feedback loops and try to be self-correcting about how society could be managed. And, you know, just for people that are reading Tragedy and Hope, it may be interesting to know that one of the people that James Roland Angell brings on is named Frank Adiolette, who was the secretary of the Rhodes Trust and one of the first Rhodes scholars in the United States. And those familiar with history will know that he worked with Abraham Flexner and Tom Jones, who were instrumental in creating the Institute of Advanced Study at Princeton, which was meant to be a clone of the All Souls College faction of the Milner Rhodes Roundtable. And, of course, you'll run into characters like Lionel Curtis, But yeah, Engel was the head of the American Psychological Association for a time. And I think it really just goes back to this world is laboratory idea. You'll see how wound psychology was instituted through Rockefeller's social science research councils in both Chicago and in Toronto. And another interesting fact about Engel is that he tried to get into Leipzig and get in under Wundt to get his PhD. And that's something that he regretted because he was not able to get in that summer. But his cousin Frank did. And, you know, these are all facts that are correlative to what Gatto brings up in this interview. The affiliations of the Yale Institute of Human Relations Advisory Council, it would be take a long time to go into here, but you'll find individuals like John Dewey and many Skull and Bones members as well. So it's kind of a nexus and a historical record of the Milner Rhodes Roundtable, the Carnegie Foundations, and the Skull and Bones Society all working together to solidify the behaviorism of John B. Watson, the experimental psychology of Wilhelm Wundt, and the functionalism and structuralism brought on later by individuals like G. Stanley Hall and William James.
So what you're saying is, even though they teach us in school all these separate and divided subjects, what you're saying is life is actually all connected together, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And that being said, we are going to move on to the next 15 minutes of the Ultimate History Lesson. And this is minutes 30 through 45 from hour two.
Her life was transformed because I treated her time and her with respect. But meanwhile, if you took any of the subject areas, you could find that she was developing muscles in each one of them. We got a call from New York. That's a city magazine in New York about midway through the school year. And they said they had heard about this and they wanted to buy the data. And they would pay $500 for it. I said, you mean you want to publish your article? Well, no, we would put her own writer's name on it. This girl, I doubt if she'd ever seen a $10 bill in her life. I'm offering her $500. She said, no, it's mine. If they want to use it, they'll put my name on it, which they weren't willing to do. So, but I know that was the beginning of a transformation in her life. A famous American writer, somebody that New York senator from Harvard, what was his name? He had a fruity voice, very famous one. Go back 10 years. Who am I talking about? He wrote...
Mario Cuomo?
No, prior to that, but he coincided with Cuomo. No, he was... he had written books about... the plight of poverty, but they weren't sympathetic books. He was nationally famous, and he was so florid as a public figure that, in any case, I had a friend who had flunked out of Cornell. I'm reluctant to mention his name without, because he's a nationally famous writer about assassinations, and this famous New York senator said publicly that he was the world's foremost assassination expert. Well, you now know that he was a flunk out from Cornell. So how did this happen? Because when he saw the Kennedy assassination, I had driven him to Cornell, and he was trying to plead his way back in. And Kennedy was assassinated. We stayed up all night. We both agreed if anything happened to the assassin, that none of the information could be trusted. And the next morning or afternoon, and that was it for the assassin. So he went back to Cornell as a flunk out, talked a big-time professor, Andrew Hacker, whose dad started the general studies program at Columbia, into giving him a PhD or the beginning of one without ever going to class. He would spend all his time writing a book about the not the Kennedy assassination, about the composition of the Warren Commission, which I thought was a very clever way to sidestep, you know, all the, you know, yellow journalism stuff. It became, Inquest it was called, it became a national bestseller. It led to an all-expenses-paid PhD at Harvard. Then he wrote a book about the De Beers diamond mines. They took him in South Africa as a house guest for a long, long time. And he wrote a book saying diamonds are essentially worthless because they have thousands of years of flawless diamonds already put away. Then he talked his way into the NBC newsroom and wrote this magnificent investigative study called News from Nowhere about how news actually is selected for transmission. In other words, everything he touched was, this is a flunk out from college. So all these anomalies from the Harlem kids, the Spanish Harlem kids, from my flunk out Cornell friend, finally shook my belief in what I had been taught, that it's an orderly universe, merit determines, and I could begin to see around me all the narratives that were disconnected from reality. They hardly were hidden at all. You know, they were all weapons of mass destruction narratives. And they occurred over and over and over again in every aspect, including in the world of medicine and nutrition. You know, there seemed to be no ethical or moral break on what insiders were able to say and all the other insiders would agree with. So that when I turned to what obviously was wrong with school, was that we were creating, I as a school teacher, was creating the hideous discipline problems that we then said we must have money to relieve. That it seemed like a closed universe in which one hand washed the other one. That all these horrible kids from horrible ghettos were perfectly able to rise into valuable contributors, and it wasn't a very long distance to go. For example, I remember one, I started a school year with, they were trying to get rid of me as a teacher. They gave me the worst class on the eighth grade. The kids were huge. They had no tradition of scholarship at all. But I determined to utterly ignore that and to say that we were going to start with Shakespeare's three most important plays. And if they could master the parts, that I was willing to cut them loose from school for months, and they could travel around elementary schools, put these plays on, and then talk about the problems of staging them, of mastering the character, or something or other. And I'd say 10 days went by. It was as if I was in a Harvard seminar, and all of a sudden, some kid burst out laughing in the middle of, oh, that this tutu solid flesh would melt, thaw, resolve itself into a dew. What are you laughing about? Don't you know? He said, we're the dumb class. You know, and from that point on, it was no longer easy because the other dumb kids had the illusion, but it wasn't an illusion. broken, but we still got some good work done. We invent the problems that we then have to solve. That's what I think all experts do. I don't think, including brain surgery, that there's anything the human skill is capable of that's very hard to learn. It takes some time. So you can benefit from prior experience, but it doesn't take anywhere near the time, expense.
So the point is that individuals have an innate, infinite potential, and that we're not limited by genes or species or
even
race.
Even lust, too. People wish to learn. It used to be called emulation. You're around somebody can do something well. Of course you respect. I mean, you're watching how they do it. Yeah, we talked earlier about the disadvantage adopted kids have. When you watch your mother and father and you're 14 months old and have no language, you're still seeing how they deal with frustration, how they merge with one another or not contend with one another. You're seeing so many hundreds of skills that, in fact, you're biologically programmed to imitate. Later, when the mind kicks in, you have some selection, which ones to, and which ones to. But we don't allow that to happen because the very first thing schools do is strip the experience base away. I mean, the easiest way to turn your kids into geniuses, I mean, by the time they're seven, is just to front load huge amounts of experience, including dangerous experience. And my favorite story is Richard Branson tells it in his autobiography. His mother, who was an airline stewardess in 1946, flying the Atlantic, so not exactly, you know, the safest thing to do, she was desperate that he wouldn't become dependent. And so when he was 4 years old, picture 48 months, she drove him miles from their London home in Shamley Green and asked him if he thought he could find his way home from there. And he said, I thought he could get out and do so then, she said. And now he said, where is he? He doesn't even have many words, you know. So 8 or 9 hours later, when he finds his way home, he said nothing in his life ever seemed hard for him to do again. He drops out of high school, never goes to college, has his first $1 million by the time he's 19 by figuring out what people need and want and giving it to them cheaper or better or bringing anyone to offer it. What would our society be if we put millions of people through the same experience? I think it would be closer to what colonial America was than early federal America, when nobody wanted to work for somebody else. They wanted an independent livelihood. It would be closer to that than the corporate hell that we have now. But the corporations following perfectly rational logic have begun to need less and less people, but they have such political control over the legislatures and the federal government that there's no way to arrest this progress. Furthermore, as I spoke at General Motors about 10 years ago, and a mid-level executive told me when I asked him, you know, you guys had the world, there wasn't any competition. What happened? you know, I remember when the Jap cars came in, they had names like the Bluebird and the Fair Lady. I mean, it was a joke. What happened? And he said, what happened was this. That engineering, which used to be the fast track to the executive suite and profit sharing and all the rest of that good stuff, stopped being the fast track. Finance became the fast track, taking these huge profits, speculating in variable rate mortgages, in foreign currencies. That became the road. The same thing that happened to the steel industry in Pittsburgh. Wasn't moved out of Pittsburgh because any of them were losing a penny. They're making great profit. It's that the Harvard B School boys said, look, you can take this money, make a lot more, and not work. Of course, that would get rid of 100,000 steel workers, truck drivers, but who the hell cares about them? Didn't Darwin say they're not evolving? They're all Irish anyway.
Well, this is the juxtaposition between eugenics and that type of mentality where people are under control, and someone like Branson who gets to go on walkabout, which is a rite of passage, which was around in the founding of this country with high literacy rates. And so when we had a high entrepreneurship, self-reliance, literacy rates, people who had critical thinking and knew how to deal with problems on their own, because if not, you might die.
Or other people think badly of you if you say, I want a job for, you know, what do you want to do? Right, right. But these different compartments are intimately interlocked. So by studying one and the other as if you're going to pass a short answer test, you're disabling your...
Fragmenting.
Yeah, yeah. The synthesizing power of your mind, which is what enables you to strike out so that history doesn't infinitely repeat itself. But now that's been restricted to such a small fragment of the population that we're in desperate trouble internationally because the Chinese, the Japs, the Malaysians can do this brain paralysis much better than we can because they have traditions that allow that. And we still turn out on the 4th of July and say, home of the free, land of the brave, whatever.
Welcome back to Peace Revolution, episode 42. This is hour two of the Ultimate History Lesson, A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto. And we just listened to minutes 30 through 45, approximately. And there's a lot of interesting things that were not brought up through public education. Again, mentioned in context of each other. And he mentions that towards the end and how none of these things are isolated, short answer test type of things. In fact, that's the method by which they purposely fragment our understanding in the first place. And instead of letting people take a normal course about learning from one thing to another and making connections logically and naturally in their mind, the school system purposely presents us with a curriculum of scattered confusion. You don't understand how biology connects to physics, connects to mathematics, connects to history, connects to humanities, all these different things, poetry. All these different things that we are forced to study in their separateness, in their compartmentalized pyramid-shaped zone where as you go up through school, people get a higher and higher education, but there are fewer and fewer people getting those compartmentalized perspectives. And what we have between each of these pyramid-shaped PhD structures with public schooling and then college and then master's degree and PhD on the top, fewer and fewer people, and that's what I mean by pyramid shape. If you line these areas of specialty up alongside each other, what you notice are these crevasses that are in between the compartmentalized versions of education, and that leaves open the opportunity for a comprehensive education where you have learned to learn anything for yourself. You can take yourself through this method to learn about anything you want and go from one subject to another and see how interconnected, like intimately interconnected, things are. nature doesn't seem to have any natural divisions between things. It's mankind, and especially some of these religious ideas through the Anglican religion, that say that it is God's will that everything be divided up into these infinite layers, and that each thing in its biological nature be locked into its layer. And if we, the public, are being deemed to be irrational, hopelessly irrational, mentally unfit to be in control of ourselves, and this small group of people who act irrational have deemed themselves our gods because they're literally amending life, productizing life, genetically modifying foods, owning the patents on the human genome, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it seems that, you know, in recognition of the who, what, when, and where of these predators, that we continue to find out how they're doing these things, and it keeps getting more and more surprising.
Well, and he's telling these stories to illustrate what you observed during the interview, which is that individuals have enormous innate potential to become self-reliant and to have an independent livelihood. And so when he's telling retelling, I should say, the Richard Branson story from his autobiography, Losing My Virginity, how I survived, had fun, and made a fortune doing business my way. What he's illustrating, because Branson was a kid in the 50s, and, you know, driving your kid out to the city these days and having them find their way home is a very dangerous thing to do. And so he's not suggesting that, but rather what he's saying is give your children the tools to become self-reliant, whether that's, you know, instilling them with a methodology at an early age to start them on the way towards critical thinking. Well,
even that's, you're talking about the transition between childhood and adulthood. And
right.
There didn't used to be this blurry line called teenager or, you know, adolescent. It was either you were a child or you were an adult. And in between, that dividing line that society put in between was called a rite of passage. And the rites of passage have been denied to generations in Western culture for over 100 years at least. I mean, we struggle to find any of those things in what we know as history. But
well, in the same public relations experts, if you will, who created the term teenager, what they're doing is they're effectively cutting off children from the experience, the wealth of experience that is their parents, their grandparents, etc., their elders, right?
And at the same time, they created a new marketing group that they could target and, you know, drive into a consumer culture, which is likewise irrational.
And so they cut them off from the tools of learning and being self-reliant and self-sufficient, etc. And at the same time, they cut them off from this critical wealth of knowledge that is encapsulated in the life's experience of their elders.
Well, because they're
and
conditioned
to think. And that all creates, you know, artificial extension of childhood.
Right. And that's how you get it. You have children who find are taught that they're adults and they're great. You know, their parents, grandparents don't have any value, that you worship what's on MTV. You worship the style culture, all these other things. And they created this intentional divide and conquer mentality within families to drive the families further apart. He talked in the first hour about how they, you know, brought the mothers into the workforce and now the labor was half the cost. And now it's all about undermining kids from a myriad of angles.
The other thing I just wanted to bring up really quickly is he talked about finance becoming the fast track. What it made me realize was that people really fail to see that there are other people out there who, when we say that they're predators, what he's really trying to point out, or what we're really trying to point out, is that these people have short-term profit motives that don't include the welfare of human beings and the environment which sustains us long-term. They're short-term profit motives, and they have no long-term plan.
Well, and the short-term profit motive means that they're not willing to go through the work to act in integrity. Rather, they're going to show you something that's on the box, and what's in the box won't be indicative of what's on the label. It's a contradiction. It's a con scheme. That's why it's short term. Otherwise, they'd be providing a product with integrity and standing behind it in this metaphor.
Well, and they create this whole idea of not having to do hard work to earn your living or to earn money, and that everything is going to come easy if you go on this, you know, fast track, et cetera. And so it just becomes really appealing.
No, I think that's great. That's a really great point. I think they play on the idea that there's, you know, there's no truth anyway. So what does it matter? Like, there's no moral or ethical break here because you know, there's no truth anyway. So we can just tell the people whatever we
need. That's the philosophic corruption of reality from Immanuel Kant. So if there's no consequence, if there's no cause and effect, if there is no objective truth and they can make truth anything they want it to be, and then our entire school system is based around that philosophy that comes through Pestalozzi and Fichte and Herbart and all these other guys who designed the Prussian education system, that's the incoherence. Go on.
Absolutely. And the mechanization of the education and the workforce becomes a facilitator of that profit motive. And then the profit motive becomes a facilitator of the education and the need to mechanize it. So it kind of self-sustains itself. And that so-called altruistic balance that they're trying to impart on us, you know, so thankfully, we should all be grateful, right? You know, it just really, that quote that he gave at the end, where the synthesizing power of your mind is what allows you to strike out at history so it doesn't infinitely repeat itself. And I just think that so encapsulates what we need to do. And of course, the trivium is a superior method to impart on people as a way to fight back.
What both you, Rich, and Lisa and Kevin just stated was really right on par with most of what I had. The only other thing I'd just like to go in a little bit more depth would be the fact that he had that quote, people wish to learn. And, you know, that's so true, and that he was identifying himself as the problem, or, as he'll later state, the lid on top of the jar, the fleas. And so, you know, it's interesting to note that coming to his own realization and then kind of making fun of his own teaching method in a way, saying, well, I was lazy and I let him go. But I just wanted to, you know, give them experience, and all of a sudden they started translating in their grades and their performance also in school as well. And he then would replace the textbooks and the different teaching materials with, you know, what he mentioned, using three of Shakespeare's most difficult plays. I don't know if that was the last 15 minutes, but either way, it was just like all these different, replacing Jack London with Moby Dick, all these different, you know, levels. It goes to show just he really, once awakening himself, used his students the way to continually feed knowledge to him about just experience and life in general, because once he realized that his students were going out and they had a general wish to learn, and that by him imparting his will, trying to keep in this compartmentalized class structure, was only causing the discipline problems, because naturally people wish to learn. That's a self-organizing function. That's that basic conscious function that makes us have that volition, that free will to choose how to go through life. And so, like, we then can be our own artists and our own musicians, our own painters in that respect, and paint our own picture in life. And, like, that's just the beauty of it. They had to essentially, you know, put a big clamp on our minds and slowly, slowly twist it until we just, you know, succumb to the pressure and the pain. But, you know, find out that it's, in fact, inflicted by a power, you know, a power class or a power elite. And the only other thing I would say about the Richard Branson story is that it's best to understand the Richard Branson story in context and understand the social conditions surrounding that era and time, as juxtaposed to our own era and time, and understand that today, with the degradation in cultural values, ethics, and morals in society, it's more important to understand, if you just give your children a method and then allow them to go out and discover some of their own truths, that will be much enough to allow them to grow into their own being.
Well said. Well, to quickly interject some history that has occurred since we actually filmed this interview. So we're all aware of this Branson quote, and it's, you know, he's drawing the differences. He's like, look how safe it was back in the 50s. You could do this with your kid. Today, you can't do that. And I believe it was in August, there was a little boy in Brooklyn who was sent to walk home, and he was murdered. He was abducted. He was tortured, and they caught the guy who did it. But the point is that in today's culture, it is greatly, greatly different than it was in the 40s or 50s. People are being sent into these crazy mentalities through radio, television, print, all these things that are being taken effect and taken root in their stimulus response culture, because they don't have these tools to think about things for themselves. And thus, they can be easily influenced through media that is designed to make them do things against their will. In fact, that's the whole purpose of not only the schooling system, but just about everything that they're printing out there as far as corporate establishment media.
It's good that Gatto mentions the whole diamond industry, because there's such a wealth of information and resources there that get into that whole scheme and scam, and then people can divest themselves of worthless diamonds. And, yeah, just this idea of separating people from knowing themselves, you know, it's like, was it Temet Noska or whatever, as the phrase for know thyself? Essentially, the biggest, you know, in the war on consciousness, the biggest weapon is to separate people from knowing themselves as a whole and as pieces of themselves, right? Whether it's their connection to their spirituality, whether it's their connection to their food or nutrition, whether it's their connection to their sense of responsibility as a citizen, like an actual citizen, not a corporate citizen, but like in community sense, and their responsibility as a parent or family member. All those things have kind of been systematically shattered over the last like 120 years. And those, you know, having a family, having a, that commonality where you all have tested your common set of ideals and principles together, and having that shattered so that you got even the family can't agree on stuff, there's then the elites know that there's no way people are going to come together around an issue to fight back, right? And they know that the family is the bedrock, the cornerstone, whatever, the foundation of effective resistance, because they themselves are a bunch of families that have been resisting against us, in a sense, right? Or to affect control. This idea of the myth of a dumb class where, you know, people, again, it just reinforces this eugenics idea where it's like, oh, you're born smart, you're born dumb, as if the kind of stimuli or environment that's shaped around you can't affect these things. You know, I think the fact that Gatto seems to have this idea that kids are born potential geniuses has a lot of strength, because in the right environment, I think any child can be nurtured in a direction that they find to be stimulating and that they excel in. It's just a matter of discovering it and having the patience to take the time to discover that child's passion. And once you do, then you stimulate it. And it's not that difficult. You just have to work at it. Yeah, and again, this idea of fracturing our self-identity also makes us kind of helpless. And because we don't look to ourselves first to solve our own problems, we'll always look to the authority figure. And that gives the authority figure enormous leeway to take advantage of that situation. And the fact that we're non-critical thinking, again, we're like perfect marks for anyone who comes along, from a security guard who's corrupt all the way up to a judge or a top politician or an international monetary fund head, you know, who is like, I'm just going to rape this chick, it's no big deal, you know what I mean, like that. And he's used to getting what he wants, and so when he gets busted, it's like, what, I, you know, he's incredulous, how, you know, I operate with diplomatic immunity. So the fact that anyone thinks that they can operate at that level means they're really detached from reality. And yeah, we just
but there's a pattern of that. You're talking about Dominique Strauss-Kahn, who got busted in New York, and that's similar to you know, what happened in Bainbridge, New York, with Rockefeller and the whole thing about Horatio Alger. We're noticing a pattern here, and I think that you articulated some of those perspectives well, because I could see a similar way that they are labeling people as a dumb class. They're stripping people of the ability to build up experiences. They're preventing people from having these tools. They recognize this potential exists in almost everybody, so therefore they have to have a compulsory form of schooling to disrupt this, to maintain, to contrive their control over us, because it's unnatural. They're fighting the laws of nature, which isn't very smart to mess with Mother Nature. So it's inevitable that what we're doing was going to happen. It's just a matter of, can we get it done quick enough before these people drive us off the cliff, metaphorically? I mean, what happens to people when you take away their ability to effectively plan for the future? Because it's what we're here is, we're here for the practical survival purpose. And if we can then survive, then we learn how to thrive and live life so we can be happy. But the basic survival that we all have to deal with, just like the squirrels and the birds and the bees, we have to deal with planning. And if they disrupt our ability to effectively plan by giving us a skewed perspective of the past and skewed perspectives of their projections and predictions of the future, then that takes away our control and turns it over to the people making those plans, which is really the corporate personhood, the corporate government that is there to basically assert control as proxy for this managerial class. When he talks about General Motors, he's literally describing how a corporation changed its mind. It imported irrationality. It changed the method by which the decisions were made. And instead of being about quality and integrity and making a reasonable profit, it went to irrational means of making extreme profits by outsourcing the labor and taking jobs away from here, because these people are not nationalists. They are internationalists. So they don't care where that corporation is. They just want to make the most money from the biggest suckers that are out there that will let people poison their environment and kill them off slowly, which I can't respect at all. So they're saying that they have a right to do this because we're not evolving. They're saying that they have the right to do this to take away our rites of passage. They're saying that they have the right to fragment our synthesizing power of the mind to take away our power to learn so that history can repeat in their favor. And what you're describing in this whole thing, I think, with Gatto is traditions of servitude. These are various layers and implementations and branding efforts of traditions of servitude. And that if Gatto has any message that's in here is that you can learn your way out of these traditions of servitude, but it's going to take some work on your part to actually observe reality and to think about it and to remove the contradictions and to find out what you're really here to do. Because if you don't write your own script, these corporations are writing the script for you, and we are all unwitting pawns until we start to grasp these tools back for ourselves. And we'll now continue with the last 15 minutes of the second hour of the Ultimate History Lesson. We'll be right back.
That allow that, and we still turn out the 4th of July and say, home of the free, land of the brave, whatever. So if someone were to walk away from this segment saying, what did he say? It's that the bad things done in school have been intellectually justified. And you're not going to change that set of mind. So all the effort you make to systematically change schooling is a huge waste of time, energy, and resources, because now the majority of the important people in the country make their living either directly from that or indirectly because you no longer have a critical mind. And what is the definition of marketing that when I took marketing at Columbia, they taught me? It's overcoming sales resistance. Well, if there is no sales resistance, you know, you do that by juggling balls and dancing. Here's a pretty girl, buy the product, you can have her. You know, it's quite a pickle that we're in. Not our managers don't think they're in a pickle, but they are too, because the Chinese, for example, are so much more well-versed, you know, in screwing rival power. We've only been around a few hundred years. Yeah, they're reeling us in very nicely, thank you. If they cashed in the bonds they hold right now, just forget, the dollar is paper. Give us our money back.
How are populations kind of prepared and indoctrinated and conditioned into receiving, you know, such low? They provide such low resistance to the Ponzi scheme mentality the predators.
Well, the interesting thing about leverage, and it has been studied since ancient Rome, is you don't have to do everybody. You just have to do a few opinion makers. They do the rest. Here's how Andrew Carnegie did it with the Protestant churches of the United States. He simply, in one fell swoop, donated a brand new organ to every church in the United States. This dyed-in-the-wool atheist opened his purse. Everybody got a new organ. Do you suppose there was anyone turned the organ down, or there was much resistance? Now, you accept the organ, but, you know, you grew up in a Christian tradition. Don't you thank Mr. Carnegie for his organ? Don't you, being human, hope that something else will follow that organ? You bet you do. How did Carnegie and Rockefeller get a hold of the schools? There were no pensions for teachers. The government didn't set up the pension system. Rockefeller and Carnegie set up the pension system out of their own pockets. And, of course, they didn't give it to everybody. your school had to conform with what they said was a balanced educational diet. 4 credits of whatever they were, 2 credits of math, whatever they were. You could compete for the pensions if you followed the Carnegie credit system. Is there any school in the country who didn't? I never heard of one. How could you? Because the local parents would say, what are you, nuts? You're not taking this free money? I mean, what you're doing isn't so great anyway. Why don't you do it his way? So this whole religion of leverage, which has just accumulated over more than 2,000 years, is utterly unknown except to seminar courses at the most elite colleges. You know, you may have a rough idea what leverage means from a physics course and see how, you know, connections, but you don't have any idea how you can plan the future for an entire region or a nation or a city by using leverage. The Chautauquas used the leverage. The best leverage available wasn't the newspapers, although it was good. It was the pulpits. And so mixed in with the real things the Chautauqua wanted to teach were traveling Christian ministers. The whole Harper's publishing empire is, I think it's Methodist, but don't hold me to that. Maybe it's Baptist. I think the Rockefellers are Baptist. Yeah. But they're not Baptist like other, you know, there's about 40 kinds of Baptists. There's one small fragment of Baptists who are like Episcopalians. I forget the name of it. When I was studying the Quaker transformation from pious, humble people to among the most powerful, certainly the most powerful small sect in the country, there are only 100,000 Quakers, they've had 2 American presidencies out of 40. So that's 5%, and they're, you know,
Nixon being the most recent, right?
Huh?
Nixon being the most recent.
Nixon and Hoover. So, you can't think clearly, and all you computer folk know that unless the data is available, you can't think clearly. Well, someone knew that thousands of years ago. What data to remove? How to spin a local authority into your scheme? Let him do the work. School teachers, I was about to say by and large are innocent. They're all innocent, because if they're not innocent, they're gotten rid of. They're drawn out of a pool of college graduates. The New York Times says are the lowest single scoring graduates on standardized exams except for school administrators, who of all the coherent occupational groups in the country, they're 50 points below the teacher group. So the managers, so-called, are the dumbest people of all. They know that their paycheck depends on, because there's 20 people to take their job. They don't want, they may sit in a parents' meeting and say, we've got to do something different. But they're listening to the tom-toms telling them what to do different. And, of course, what to do different always says, identify the most influential parents. They're not always the richest. Do something different for those people. They'll be gone in 3 or 4 years. Then go back and do what you always did. So that's, if you looked at schools in 1905 and schools today, the correspondences are overwhelmingly similar. You would not say, wow. You would say, hey, history hasn't moved.
Frederick Gates helped out Rockefeller at a time when the family was getting a bad reputation, and like Carnegie, they were having a lot of labor disputes. How does the idea of philanthropy and altruism affect American education?
Philanthropy and altruism, as it occurs through the institution of the private corporate foundation, is the explanation for what's called American education. Let's us call it American schooling. That's a pretty comprehensive condemnation. Do I have any evidence for that? Yes, I do. The two congressional investigations of where schools came from, one in 1915 by a guy named Walsh, one in 1959 by a guy named Carol Reese, both came to the identical conclusion that all the mysteries vanish, at least source mysteries, when you see how the foundations, which don't spend very much money, use leverage to control the curriculum, the testing system, the public perception of what's going on. And of those foundations, until very recently, Rockefeller, Carnegie, and Ford were the ringleaders. They had divided responsibility. Ford took let me not misstep here.
Rowan Gaither was in charge of Ford at the time, and he had met with Norman Dodd, and Gaither says, well, Mr. Dodd, you know, we have direct directives from the White House, and we at the Ford Foundation are ex-CIA or OSS.
The White House, back in the 20s and 30s, set up conferences of experts in order to homogenize expert opinion, because inside the expert body, there were colossal names, and if they spoke, all the other chords fell into line. I think Ford took over the psychological output of schooling. Rockefeller and Carnegie, in different ways, were attempting to globalize this thing. The Carnegie Foundation, still today, if you go up to their library, I think it's in Ossining or around there, and just read their annual report for the Carnegie Corporation, everything you ever saw on the front page of the New York Times in relation to schooling was cooked up in the project offices, and then it's dumped on the world through the control of the media. How's the media controlled? Well, it's controlled through advertising. That's all. You can use your friends to buy more or buy less. When they come and say, why aren't you advertising? When you say, well, your point of view is so radical.
Advertising?
It's done.
All right, cool. All right, so let's take at least a 15-minute break, cool this room off.
I think the mechanics of how it's done is the most useful thing to someone just new to this. Because
yeah.
They say, well, it seems like everyone would have to be in on this, not only a few.
Right, absolutely.
So,
right.
Yeah, we can cover that. We'll cool the room off. Let's get the lights off.
Do you want to rewind that last paragraph just a little bit, and that could be spliced back in there? Because I think it cuts out on, like, the last thing he says.
I'll just explain what he's saying. He's saying
that
control of the media is done through advertising, and that if someone doesn't like your advertising, they'll be like, oh, we're not carrying it anymore, right? So there's this symbiosis, right? And then he's talking about what he says after the cut is a lot of people think in order for this to be done, It would have to be, everyone would have to be in on it. And then he's referring back to the idea of leverage, that they don't have to own the entire corporation to have controlling manipulation of it. They don't have to be in charge of the entire foundation to have controlling interest of it. If they're giving, if Carnegie, Ford, Rockefeller Foundation is giving out grants and money, that is the control they need to fund Guerrilla News Network, who gets money from Ford Foundation or one of these other entities that is so-called alternative media, but actually under the control, because if that's where you're getting your funding from instead of directly from the people you're trying to help, if you have a middleman in there, then there's all sorts of things that can go awry.
Well, and it brings up the recent J.P. Morgan Chase donation of $4.6 million to the New York City Police Foundation. And it begs the question, what kind of leverage or influence does that buy?
Well, and then when that happens before people start to occupy Wall Street, so a big bank that's going to be protested against sniffs this out because they own all the social networks and fund all these things and they have this information. So they say, hey, we're going to give you guys $4 million and, you know, act as if. And so instead of dressing up in riot gear, you see all these cops in New York who are all in basically plain street clothes. And what that tells me is that it's under control. They have control over that event. It's not an unknown that they're managing. It's something that's already been paid for. They're going to beat the protesters back, et cetera, if they have to, using the pepper spray. And what you see is a lot of guys in white shirts acting like Nazis. And what is the root cause of that? Is that because those guys aren't getting raped in their pensions? No, they're getting raped just like everyone else. They've just been paid a little extra go money to act as if. And so the sooner we recognize that if they were really uncertain or if that was really a threat, they would be prepared to defend it. And that's why I don't think it's a strategic work of action. Once you understand the root causes, you'd walk away from that and actually get some of this stuff done, I think.
Well, and whether it's Rockefeller and Carnegie setting up the pension system and controlling teachers and not just, well, teachers' education and then the curriculum, there's this pattern of money buying influence, and those with the money obviously have the most influence, and those would be the managerial class.
Well, I think he tells a story about Carnegie and donating the organs. I think that's just a metaphor for a bigger pattern in history that's going on, is that Carnegie, who is as he describes, a dyed-in-the-wool atheist, right, is able to buy off all these people who are in churches just by buying them a new fancy thing. And his money that's coming from J.P. Morgan and all these other people, it buys them this new fancy thing that allows them to worship God in a better way. Right?
Bought him a church organ so that the churches would believe in him.
Right. And so then these same people create the teacher's pension system, the tenure system, the retirement system, and they also create the General Education Board. And all these things that they're teaching that are unknown except that in the elite level are used as leverage against the populations of these schools and these towns and cities and whatnot, right? So if you can't think clearly, unless you have this data available and they are occulting or hiding this data, which is useful information, and you understand that if they're hiding this information and that the definition of education is the unocculting or unhiding or revealing of this information, then you would see that teachers and administrators, it's not surprising that they're among the lowest scoring test groups and that they're the dumbest people of all, according to the system's own stats that they help administrate, right? So it's no surprise that all this is going on, because their job isn't to unoccult information. They don't have to be smart and aware and savvy in their research. All they have to do is repeat a pattern of history that has allowed this managerial class to control so many without effective contest. Then when you get into this guy, Frederick T. Gates, and who brings this idea of philanthropy to Carnegie and Rockefeller and these guys and says altruism, acting like you're giving your money away, that'll fool the people into thinking that you're not really in control of them. But really all they did was create these foundations, and for at least 50 years these things go on, because the Walsh Committee in 1918, I think it was, started to investigate this, but then there was a war going on at the same time, right? So what's the people's priorities? And again, in the 50s, when the Reese and Cox Committee look into this, they find that all these foundations don't have American interests or educational interests in mind. They're trying to create an international society that they can blend in with the Soviet Union and this New World Order idea of managing people that they have. And that's all on congressional record. I think it's a travesty that at some time during our high school experience, college experience, that this stuff isn't mentioned to us and that our parents and grandparents and people around us aren't aware of what's going on. It's almost horrifying if we didn't have to actually deal with it and set the fear aside, right? But the guys like Norman Dodd who came out and talked about foundations and their influence and leverage that these people were having, and he worked for J.P. Morgan first, right? So he had insight into the, what they were doing as the rackets in the financial industry versus the rackets that they are now raining down on the education, you know, in the public schooling. And I think that what Gatto says is it's the, you know, it's this tradition of servitude that is put through the public schooling because it's not an education system. It, you know, he says it's American public schooling as we know it today was created by these robber barons and has only been challenged in Congress a couple times in history, the Walsh Commission and the Rees-Cox Commission.
Yeah, like there's a quote here I'd like to follow up then that with Norman Dodd gave an interview. I don't know if this was with Stan Monteith, an interview with Norman Dodd, 1980, a few years before his death, and it's from Radio Liberty, but the quote goes, "And they, together, the Rockefeller Foundation and the Carnegie Endowment, decided that the crux of the matter lay in their ability to alter the teaching of American history in this country. So they approached the then three of the most prominent historians with that suggestion, and they were turned down flat. So they then decided they would have to build their own stable of historians. And so they then approached the Guggenheim Foundation, which specialized in awarding fellowships, and said figuratively, when we find a likely young man who's headed to become a teacher of American history, and you will grant him on our say-so a fellowship, and the answer was yes, we will. So they gradually assembled 20, and they took these 20 to England, where they briefed them as to what was expected, and that became the Nucleus American Historical Association, to which ultimately the endowment made a grant of $400,000 for a study to be made, which would conclude the future of this country was to be." And I find that telling because he mentions that Carnegie and Rockefeller set up these conference of experts.
Well, I believe that Carol Quigley also mentions in his interview that's available on YouTube that the American Historical Association had already been taken over by that period of time. So.
All right. So it's interesting because I had to correlate with the idea of conference of experts, just some of the ways in which this was brought up, because this is a big thing in science. The idea of peer review is kind of absurd. If you're able to reproduce a test and to give it to other scientists, they should be able to reproduce it as well. It's just a method. So it's just the same idea of assembling experts, essentially filter knowledge. It's like a filtration system, essentially. And they themselves act as the filter and make sure that nothing gets through that they don't approve of first, you know, firsthand. Or doesn't upset their paradigm that's already established.
Yeah, and another way that they were able to use this idea of leverage, you know, early on, as he was saying, with the Chautauquas and the pulpit and the press and how they, you know, as he put it, want to spin a local authority. I would offer a modern incantation of some of this same leverage in that Yale University, under the tutelage of James Roland Engel, who I discussed a little bit earlier, and Mark Arthur May, were involved in the creation, which, of course, the funding came from the Rockefeller Foundation, of what was called the Teaching Film Custodians, which was one of the first companies set up as a way to introduce the techniques, the behavioral techniques, the Wundtian psychology, the frustration aggression studies. It was a way to introduce this to the children in schools through the use of film, which of course was a new technology at the time. So this harnessing of leverage took place on a modern level. I just urge people to look into the Teaching Film Custodians, the Motion Picture Research Project, which was funded by the Motion Picture Association of America, and they gave $100,000 at the time to set up 7 experimental classrooms to determine what kind of research would be needed and what methodology would be best in imparting these educational films to the students. That's one modern incantation of that, and some of the people that are involved in it are also involved in the intelligence services. Isaiah Bowman is one of the founding members of the Council on Foreign Relations. He was a board member on the Teaching Film Custodians Incorporated. He was also a part of the inquiry in 1917. Carl T. Compton would be another individual I would recommend looking into. He was on the Manhattan Project. And it's just, you know, it's interesting how they're able to, over time, continually use the same methodology to leverage the masses. And, you know, because they were using what universities always do, which is to take credit for the individual inventions of the individuals that happen to be attending there, and then they're able to use that technology at its infancy in a way to corrupt it to where we all accept this either-or mentality where people will come to you later and say, well, you really can't be against that because such and such good came from it. And I think we need to be able to separate that in order to move past it and to explain these things without falling for that false dichotomy.
I also heard you bring up the term Chautauqua again, because Gatto mentioned it in several hours of conversation, and this was this phenomenon that would roll into town and it would set up tents and very charismatic speakers would take the floor and try to convince you of these various ideas. And the Chautauqua movement was headed up by William Rainey Harper, who was in charge of Harper's Magazine, which was a very influential magazine of its time. And later, Rockefeller gives $80 million to found the University of Chicago, and he installs William Rainey Harper as a president. Now, the University of Chicago then goes through the 20th century producing all sorts of artificial experts, et cetera, et cetera. I believe our current sitting president is a graduate of University of Chicago, as well as some of these other elite boarding institutions and colleges, et cetera. Very interesting experience for a president, but I digress. The ideas that he's bringing forth here are really showing you the roots of who funded the public school system, and that it's not just public school system. It's the adoption system. It's the eugenics system. It's your healthcare system. These things are all connected. The financial woes that are going on right now are orchestrated by the same people who turned off our curiosity through a system of compulsory schooling. So they're organized. They have a plan. They're together on their side. They are not really arguing with themselves. They are executing as planned over centuries. So until we get understanding among us and be on the same page that, you know, we as human beings have natural predators, and the way that we can protect ourselves from these natural predators is to be able to recognize the signs of deception. And without being able to plan effectively based on information that actually exists in reality, this struggle for survival can't be effective. And so I think that's really what he's bringing to bear in these couple hours thus far.
I wanted to mention that Gatto was talking about China's holdings and, you know, China, if they pulled out, we'd be done for. But I thought it's important to bring up again Clint Richardson's research that shows that our local city corporations and county corporations and state corporations, et cetera, are the ones that own all of these corporations. And the U.S. still has so many trillions of dollars invested in China, holding China up, that it would create a cyclical, you know, implosion on China, I think, if they did that. You know, and I think China is probably one of the largest, we're one of the largest importers of Chinese goods.
So that's a trick. They're both interconnected, so they both would fall. It's like the both perfect.
Yeah, there's definitely a symbiotic relationship, and there's not different owners of China. The same installations of controlling people, whether it's communism, socialism, capitalism, all these isms are individual social management systems. That's why they end in ism. Autonomy, thinking for yourself, being self-reliant, does not end with an ism. Okay? So an ism is an idea thought up by someone else. Anarchism, who came up with that? Godwin, right? Is that right?
Yep.
Anarchism is an idea by Godwin, who was an elite, and anarchism doesn't work because you can't have no government with at the same time having no intellectual self-defense. The only time that government becomes not necessary is when the general population has intellectual self-defense skills and can make decisions on their own behalf, which lead to survival. And when you can make your own best decisions, then you don't need an external third party who is not using any data from your life to make decisions on your behalf against your will. So, since it's all about freedom of the body, and we learn that in order to enslave our bodies, they just enslaved our minds. They took away the freedom which is available through our mind. What process makes it available? Learning. Learning starts with observing and asking questions, and then continuing to add thinking in between the stimulus that you received and the response that you give. That is literally how they control people, and that's how we can learn our way out.
I was going to add that, you know, with all these thousands of years when slavery existed, that they outwardly, that they had plenty of time to develop new methods of controlling the slaves that didn't require shackles. And as Paul so eloquently put it, you know, a while ago towards the beginning, we're just in the newest stage of the operating system, and they've got it better and better, and they can, you know, instead of controlling 10 or 100 slaves, now they can control hundreds of millions of slaves. And it's time for the slaves to get the operating system that's being used against them.
Well, that's a great observation, because we are all individual human beings. and they can't control individual human beings. That's why they need public schooling to make us all into predictable, interchangeable parts. And then as long as we are interchangeable parts that are unique, that we have a common operating system of logic and communication, but we are all intellectually unique people who are following our own paths and our own volition, that is one way that they control us. So we have to become free in that way. The other way that they control us directly is through stimulus and response. And the way that we take our control back that in that instance is to directly insert thinking between the stimulus we're receiving through our five senses and our percept. We have to be very careful about how we form our concepts in our mind and make sure that there's no contradictions and that we're actually talking about substantial reality. And then we can give our response. But now our response is going to be in the form of an intelligent decision, an informed reaction that is strategic and takes constructive action that is not just what they hope that they've programmed into us, which is a fearful reaction where we go and hide instead of looking at these things, because any of these fears, confusions, frustrations can be examined through a methodology that yields knowledge and understanding, and that gives you serenity in your life. And I think that's what we're all searching for, because that's what they try so hard to take away from each and every individual on this planet that is not deemed to be one of the elect that can rule over other people. I think that idea of ruling over other people is a little bit antiquated and is certainly outdated by this point. But it couldn't be until we learned how to think for ourselves. That's the true difference between a child and an adult. An adult can take actions for self-preservation and plan for their future, and children cannot yet do that. I think that blurring the line with this whole idea of being teenagers, no, that's just society trying to extend your adolescence so that you can be dependent on a system that preys on your every waking and sleeping moment these days, right? So this is all about providing the tools and the knowledge that these tools are out there so that people who are hearing this for the first time can find their way through the dark to turn on the light and be able to go around and look at things anew, because you're actually looking at them for yourself instead of through the lenses provided by the public school system. And they provide a set of lenses that do not help you see things clearly and in focus. They provide a lens that breaks your curiosity, that fragments your ability to make coherent understanding of the world. And in that way, they use literacy as a form of slavery. And it's our job for each of us to learn to exercise observation and critical thinking.
I was just thinking that this age in adolescence, when kids come to a point, usually around 15, 16 years old, when they think they know it all and they have a false sense of education, and you know, the grown-ups, the older people, they're just stupid. They don't know anything. This is the age when those children should have finished with a foundation of the liberal education.
And begin taking experience with their family and parents and drawing some of this experiential wisdom from their...
What I'm getting at, though, is, you know, they're lacking what would have really, in a sense, given them the ability to know just about everything with a false sense of that at almost at the same time.
And I just wanted to add that the idea of extending adolescence way beyond the teenage years, turning people into adulterated children instead of them becoming grown-ups. And I think grown-up is more of an experiential thing than a temporal thing. Like, just because you've been here for 18 years doesn't make you a grown-up. I know 40-year-olds that still haven't grown up, you know. And it's a matter of having an experience to look back and go, oh, I want to learn from that experience and grow so that I don't make as many mistakes, so that I make more satisfying decisions, so that I can take on more responsibility. And it's, schooling essentially is the opposite of that. It teaches you, it takes you away from your parents who might teach you a sense of responsibility at a younger age and prolongs the authoritative dictation of facts and answers. And it does get more complicated to engage the mind more as it gets, you know, older. But it's still not, you know, except for like a handful of teachers, I wasn't taught independent critical thinking, right? I had a few teachers who knew that this was their one chance, and so they would stress that, and it was lost on a lot of the class. But, you know, people, you remember it, that someone was saying, hey, other people are going to want to try and form your thoughts for you, and it's really easy to let that happen. It takes one brain process to follow orders. It takes two brain processes to question orders, right? And people are lazy enough to go like, well, it's just half a brain process.
Yeah, it's a shortcut to thinking.
Right? And so as long as we realize that we have this potential at a younger age to engage ourselves in our curiosity and critical thinking, that's going to result in our creativity, in being able to discover and follow our passion. If we don't, there are 1,000 amusements, right? Opportunities for not thinking that are presented to us, a myriad of different amusements, and they're easy to get wrapped up in. These are time wasters. These are things that allow you to spend your time frivolously with no results, no tangible reward, and no return on investment for yourself, for your time and energy. That's why there's billions of dollars put into these amusements by the system, because it's the most sophisticated form of bread and circuses, right? It's junk bread and violent circuses now, so virtual circuses. So, you know, keep that in mind when you're thinking about how you use your time and how you manage your time, and you'll discover that your curiosity and your creativity serve your time and get you a much better return on investment than any distractions or entertainment.
Well, I think also from the evidence that we've seen over the past couple of years, people from in high school all the way through people in their 90s have grasped this and have started their mind working. So it's about changing habits, and it's not that you can't teach an old dog a new trick, but you just need to understand that learning this new trick plays into your survival and allows you to possibly the first time get a real grip on reality that has not been presented to you but actually exists. And you'll find that all those things that you felt you were inefficient in, all of a sudden you become effective and efficient because now your wheels aren't spinning all the time because you have a way to anchor to objective reality through logic and through this communication system that we can use between each other called talking. And so by testing out ideas on each other and improving our perspectives, we can go through a process that allows us to supersede these trivial yet consistently effective processes that they've put around us to keep us from thinking for ourselves. But it proves that anyone at any age can decide to start changing their habits, reprioritize their time, and start doing better things with their energy that actually have something to do with survival. And what public school does is focus usually on a bunch of things that they say are important, but really when you get down to it, they're not important to your survival. They are absolutely necessary to the survival of the institution that is trying to change you or adjust you to their will, not according to yours.
The local authority that they became so well-versed in spinning has just grown. The world is the local authority, and if we're not careful, we become that local authority in the way that we interact with others.
That's the consequence of going through the system without having your volition as part of it. If you're not making your choices, if you're just going by what's being told, then you are fully becoming part of that system without even thinking about it. And I think every individual deserves and has the right to the opportunity to at least say, if someone else is going to take over my thinking and my mind, then it should at least be at your approval because you're too lazy to learn how to use the greatest gift anyone's ever had, which is consciousness, for yourself. You want someone else who's learned to use consciousness to drive your mind and your body. That's your prerogative, but I think it should be an informed decision on your part and not just something that the top couple percent assumes that you don't want your life here, that you can't write your own script, that you don't have any purpose here, but that which they have written in for you. And I'm just saying that everyone should have their opportunity to write their own script. So until next episode, when we'll cover hour 3 of the Ultimate History Lesson, I'd like to thank each and every one of you for participating. I think your commentary has helped to illustrate that which John has studied but wasn't able to, for time reasons, articulate for himself, because we've been taking a look at the primary references, the materials from which these ideas can be drawn for themselves. And again, these will be in the episode notes as well as posted on ultimatehistorylesson.com. I'd like to thank everybody in the audience for tuning in, and we will see you next episode for Peace Revolution, episode 43. Thank you.
own bad time. Well, I own bad time. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I own bad time. No, I own bad time. You can stand my crown. Oh, won't be turned around in a world that keeps on pushing me around. I stand my ground. I will fall back down. And I